soon as it'll be, they have to go. I said, heaven first, those of you where I would like to welcome you. I see I'm going to many members of the series of the papers.
I was thinking about the classes.
And finally, the services should be efficient In other words, they should not be any duplicate administrative structures that are set up in national provincial and district here. Mm-hmm. And even the ones that exist now should actually be eliminated in terms of qualification. Reminding ourselves of the objectives of the National Health Insurance is that there is a need to create a single fund which will pool the risk in a society from, you know, the healthy and the sick, the disabled, the non-disabled, and injured and non-injured, all of those risks pooled together, and also pool the funds from the state as well as the funds from the individual and the funds from companies, pool all of those resources together in order to be able to create a single fund and deliver the services for all. And then the census should be procured on behalf of the entire population so that they can use the economies of scale, to use the power and muscle of the NHI funds in order to be able to provide services to all. The other issue which is of serious concern for this committee is improving resources for the capital sector. The public sector needs to be resourced financially in order that it can be able to increase human resources, to increase the equipment it needs, to have access to medicine, and be able to deliver the services of supporting the living. And then the final objective of the NHI is to improve access to quality health services for all. It's important that the money that is being obtained should be used to improve the services, the health services, so that the public can be able to use the services at any level where the supporting for them to do. What I try to do is kind of answer the question that you have. If you look at what the Green Paper says, what can be done, and say, can be done, because all of what the Green Paper does is make the foundation upon which service improvement should take place. We have a final policy position which will be coming very soon, you know, from government. I don't know exactly when, but I do know that a lot of work has been going on because since the release of the Green Paper in August, there's been a lot of public consultation, and we'll be working on this for the Department of Health, and we'll be reviewing all of those inputs from the public, and they are busy preparing the white paper, and I'm sure in terms of their timeline, they would be very much interested in releasing it. They have plans to release it around December 2011, according to this. So I'm certain that input they got were so much that there's a need for them to go through and evaluate them and then be able to come back and put something in the cabinet which will eventually end up here in Parliament. The other major change that has been going on, which they have promised to do during August 2011, was the application of regulation on the definition of hospitals. In other words, to determine what level of service should be provided and which service is actually the national and which one should be made provincial. And we did a promise to, you know, designate the level of service that is provided by each one of those categories of hospitals. And I must say that they have published the regulations on the treatment of hospitals and social management of hospitals. They released it last year, and they have been, you know, working on that. But finally, I want to say for this social management reform and information of hospitals is really to advertise the appointment of health facility managers. I'm sure you heard before that the concern was that many of the people that were appointed from my hospitals do not have the skills to be able to do that. They revamped the whole situation. They advertised the post of CEOs and made the point that those people are qualified. And then we went around and doing the interviews and appointed. Some of them were even appointed and others, you know, they are in the process of appointing. The other major change that was required is to improve the investment system. In other words, to maintain the revenue in facilities, you know, so that the facilities themselves should be able to have the capacity to receive the revenue. Like the NHI would not require people to pay at the point of service according to the policy, it is necessary that those people that are not covered by the NHI should be able to pay. And to do so, it means that the institution must have the capacity to actually process the revenue that they get and be able to use it, you know, appropriately. And they have to be able to develop their holding scheme also to chemical investment, especially for services that are provided in hospitals, specialists, you know, services. So the department plans public regulations for comments on hospitals and their retention, as well as developing a holding scheme. And they plan to do that in April 2011, and of course they have gone ahead and published a notice of their retention, and they did last year. And they advanced the medical research council to develop a scheme beginning in UPS. So they have been waiting on this particular scheme that will be used to hold the health services that are provided. The other issue that is necessary to run the health services very well is having a set of norms and standards for the quality of health services, so that whenever somebody goes to the facility, they should know the kind of services they should be receiving. And to that end, the department plan to establish the Office of Health Standards and Compliance, and that will be saved setting up, preparing a bill and getting it to Parliament. And in addition to that, appointing staff, you know, who are going to be working in that particular Office of Health Standards and Compliance. They have seen the bill, you know, in Parliament in 2011, and the way parliamentary hearings have started, you know, in part of this year. And they were going to start the training and appointing inspectors. They were going to train 10 inspectors, but they ended up training and appointing 20 inspectors, you know, as of December. So at least it sounds like from where things are going, they are very much on track with regards to activities. Now, improving the quality of the infrastructure for health services are a key critical aspect of ensuring that any standard infrastructure and that people do have access to use the services. It requires that the health services be facilities to determine if they comply with the health standards. So to do so, the Department of Health has to undertake, they made a pledge that they are going to undertake an audit of all health facilities and issue some improvement and certification, in other words, indicate to the public that this facility is actually running well. And we had targets that they have set up, and it's shown on this particular slide. That they have been to audit, you know, close to 3,962 facilities. And that was to be done by end of October 2011. I must say that by January 2012, they've already done more than 23,000 facilities. They've been audited. They have set up, you know, facilities to maintain, and they have appointed the four provinces, and that continues now to improve, to go through all the information, pass the information they receive. They are going through that, and it's taking a short lot of people, a little bit longer, to try to find a balance or if as soon as that is done, they will be able to come. One of the key institutional infrastructure needed in order to run the National Health Insurance is the District Health Authority. And the District Health Authority would be an institution that would have the power to run the population health at the district level. They would be able to understand the profile of the health in that particular district and be able to plan the services in that particular district. And to do so means that they must have the capacity to be able to do that work. And that means that the Department of Health has got a big task of actually giving capacity to certain institutions in terms of management and governance. In addition to that, they have selected some pilot sites in the first 10 districts to see whether we can be able to get NHI piloted in different districts. I'll come back to that a little bit later. And in addition to that, they have to develop a test of certain packages that are going to be offered at NHI. And furthermore, they were expected that you know, by June 2015, you know, they would have to extend those pilots from 10 to 20 districts out of about 50 districts. So this was a planned phase-in process of actually improving the health services in preparation for implementation of NHI and protecting the rights of our own children from the services. The business plan were developed for the creation of the NHI Business Management Governance Structure, and that has been going on. A pilot group was selected in February 2020. So I must say all the provinces have now completed their business plan, and they've submitted the rules in the plan, and they are in the process now of actually implementing those plans. And of course, there are challenges that will come back to those later on. Now, the process of reforming the district health authority is a quite complex one, because it means that the structure itself must have few people who can plan, who can coordinate, and who can ensure that services are delivered within the district. And in other words, there has to be an institutional and governance framework that is going to be common across that across the district. Now, this needs to be expedited. This is an area where there are challenges, you know, and those challenges are because of failing, they don't have an appropriate meal, it's still mixed, and they don't have capacity to plan as well as they should be planning. So this challenge is the one that needs to be addressed, and I'm going to be recommending at a later point that the conditional grant actually be changed the way it needs to be done in order to make sure that capacity can actually be created at the district level. And I'll come back to that and address the issues that we need. Now, in order for a district to provide the services, it also needs to have medically qualified people, not only managerially qualified, but also medically qualified. And to do so, the department has made a promise to identify all the schools that are needed for clinical specialists, to appoint those specialists, and to contract with academic institutions on a rotational scheme in order to have, you know, people trained and then be able to deliver the services. And all of this was planned to be done, you know, by around February 2012. It's encouraging that the Department of Health has developed a job description, they've played the arts and many favors. They have quite a lot of good responses. More than 3,000 people responded to the 450 the doctors. It's encouraging that the doctors are actually wanting to move from wherever they were to come into to come into this district health authority. Candidates were shortlisted and they've been going around and doing the interviews, and in some cases they've been able to appoint some of the people and some of the people they've already started. The other responsibility of the Department of Health is really to train human resources for primary health care level and make sure that they are functioning primary health care schemes. In so doing, it means that they have to come up with a new strategy for the primary health care re-engineering. In other words, they will have a municipal work-based primary health care agent. In other words, their primary health care people have to be trained and placed in a ward within the district. They will train 5,000 primary health care agents to appoint the first 5,000 of those agents, and then also make sure that they define the primary health care tool, and then they appoint the people to work within the primary health care team. And those people to be supported by the clinical specialists that we talked about earlier on. All of this has been done by April this year. It's pleasing that even though they did not reach the target at the time of 5,000 CHP agents, they have 4,500 CHP agents who are trained, and they have set up 143 teams for the pilot district, you know, in 2012. And then they also added another team, you know, in March, one team that they established in March. So essentially, in the district, they are beginning to struggle with the concept of municipal-based primary health care on the basis of the new framework that has been set up. The other big thing that the tribe and state were going to do last year was to set up a school-based primary health care facility. And that has meant that they should set the formulas and establish the databases within the schools and, the school health nurses, including the retired nurses. Because of capacity constraints, they have to go back and look at those nurses that are retired to say, can they come back? They have actually identified the nurses set up the database. They have identified the schools where this should be happening. They appointed school-based team led by nurses. And also it's good to know that there has been quite good work that has been done. last, I think the last part is for 1711, basic structure. Of 1712, the students have told them that they're alone, and it was focused on the eyesight, hearing, oral hygiene, on immunization, on de-weaning the children, on treatment of minor conditions, especially preservation, and on counseling and sexual and reproductive health issues, and all facilities via mobile health units, and also prevention of drug and alcohol use and abuse. So this is a program on primary health care that is actually beginning, you know, to function, and hopefully if it does very well, it should reduce the number of visits to the healthcare facilities and reduce the overcrowding, and therefore begin to improve the quality, you know, of health services. The other thing I just want to touch on is the question of human resources. Now, there's a need to design a human resource strategy for any child. There is a human resource strategy that has been set up for the whole country. But there is a need for beginning to focus much more on the needs of human resources for any child to ensure that it can actually be executed at academic institutions, at learning colleges, as well as special training, you know, at district level. And I'm glad to say that, you know, although that has not been done yet by the Department of Health, they already have a human resource strategy, which forms a good base for now developing a strategy for any child human resource. Coming now to the statement of the Minister for Finance for the medium-term budget in the policy statement, we need to start recognizing one thing, that any child is a reality, but it can only, you know, be successful if more funds are available. And I say that the chair is saying that prioritization would have to be done within the budget. One is not really asking that we should go and borrow more in order to be able to get service health care to improve, but essentially to really reprioritize within the budget, because once there is policy, one has to make sure that that policy is effectively implemented. So the Minister of Finance says the government is going to take the steps that is implementing NHI with this MCDS, indicating that the coverage is everyone while funding is based on their ability to pay. Treasury indicates that an additional 6 billion rand will be needed in 2014-15, but they say that it is currently provided for it, mainly because of two things. One, they say there has to be progress on institutional reform. And the additional force they're talking about is the issue of district authority. And secondly, which I've talked about earlier on. Secondly, it's on the issues related to supply chain management and delegation. It's most important for delegations and making sure that delegations are done no longer, certain positions no longer be filled by the government, but be filled by the hospital, for example. Giving hospital autonomy to be able to manage, you know, the services. I'm sure that has to be possible given the fact that the CEOs of hospitals are being supported in the healthcare sector. Then the next thing is that they say that the second condition is that there must be progress of capacity of the health system to provide services. And I must say that with the new plans that are there, clearly there is an indication from the government of health that they are developing the capacity to be able to provide the services. So, you know, Treasury argues that all of these things that the department is doing cannot be reliably determined. So us, it means that there needs to be a quantitative assessment of progress that they've made. And that needs to be done in order to unlock, you know, the additional funds. And obviously, you know, you cannot be able to do that unless you actually have the funds to be able to, you know, to finalize all of those things, so capacity development, logistics. So it's almost like chicken and egg issue, you know. It isn't to be done, but I can't give you money until you do this. And then you need the money to be able to do this. So I think this is something that we should look at. Now, there will be a proposal on revenue options for any child, so for how any child is going to be funded. And it will be coming from February end of this year. This is according to the Medium Term Budget Policy Statement. It should shed a lot of light in terms of how any child is going to be funded, whether it will be funded last different tax, current general revenue, or additional tax that will be split between employer and employee, and all that. So those are the things that the Treasury is looking at, and look forward to seeing that document when it comes out. Now, the next thing I want to address is how they are funding NHI in the transitional phase. In looking at the NCDTS statement, they indicated that the NHI would be funded temporarily via the provisional grant until such time that the National Health Insurance funds itself will be set up. Now, the provisional grant was established in April this year, and they provided funding of 150 million, 350 million, and 500 million to the NCEF. And the money was to be used to test innovations that are necessary for implementation of NHI. So people have to be looking on the ground and say, how best can we actually implement NHI and test out which would then inform the final plan, you know, of NHI. Secondly, we want to undertake health system strengthening initiatives that we identified at the district level, because they've done all these sort of facilities, they found out what the challenges are, and now they really need to undertake, you know, health system strengthening and using that money. And you can see 150 million rand for 10 districts is actually not enough. And that is why the winners are went ahead and added another district and put in more money in order to be able to do what they needed to do. Third purpose of the conditional grant was to provide strategic resources for supporting the pilot district in implementing health services regarding interventions. And these interventions were meant to address the priority conditions, you know, that cause mortality or that happens as a result of the Millennium Development Goals. Now, what's worrying with regard to the funding for healthcare, if you look at what is in the NDCCS, is that the health sector GDP is actually declining. It declined slightly from 4.1% in 2011-2012 to 3.9% in 2013-14. Now, for a program that is supposed to be a priority, one of the top priorities, high priorities of government, it surprises that we're actually seeing a decline. We should not be seeing a decline if it's a priority. The priority means that you say, in addition to, okay, let me take an account of everything else, this is going to be protected. And we don't see that protection in the budget. So, in addition to public health spending as a percentage of government spending, we're seeing that it's also declining. I mean, we're seeing a decline from 13.7% in 2011 to 13.4% in 2013-14. So even in the total envelope, the proportion for health is actually shrinking slightly. And that is the concern. It was supposed to be going up. At least according to the green paper, in terms of what is actually required for any time. While we understand that provision of health funds will become very expensive, the state is capacitated to deliver a very improvement of institutional reform. Without funding, as I indicated earlier, this issue is not going to be very accurate. I think it is important that the reiterations and concerns that the MCTPS is not giving sufficient money for the provisional grant in order to be able to improve the state to deliver. But I'm aware of the fact that there are constraints also in spending the conditional grant, so it's not so easy. The spending on this conditional grant is currently hampered by a lot of factors, such as lack of dedication to teams that are managing identified interventions in the NHS kind of time, and also challenges with the supply chain management, you know, within the provinces. These are things that need to be addressed. So it's not only to say here is the money, but it's also saying, well, even if you give the additional money, this is what you need to do in order to be able to process, you know, the improvement and preparation for NHI. Now, the budget allocation to the NHI conditional grant are critical, as I indicated, to have meaningful real-life demonstration of various components of the NHI that should cover those services, especially if we look at those services at the primary care level. Now, the plan committed to the power now, the NHS is the power, to increase funding for this conditional grant, as articulated in our meeting, you know, last year, and I was glad that the chair has indicated that it was what are really in so that we can be able to make it sustainable. So we will be looking and hoping that we will be assisting the country by requesting an increase in terms of the conditional grant. The other constraint in spending on conditional grant is that there has to be a change in what the conditional grant is supposed to do. it should cover for KC engineering stream, technical services at KC level, and at the district level, as well as other activities that are directed at the premium operation work, you know, for establishment of the research fund. So we're saying that it must not be kept only for experimental purposes, but it must also be money must be made available, you know, in order to improve the services themselves, and at the same time to establish the fund. Now, we're suggesting that the conditional grant be changed from a Schedule 5 NCC to Schedule 7, you know, in, Schedule 5 grant. The Schedule 5 grant determines for the province what exactly the national expected to do on the basis of non-standard standards and OSHA. And they leave the provinces to do that, and they monitor whether the province is actually doing that or not. And Schedule 7 would actually change the way those funds are used, because the provinces and the national staff would have to be seconded to the provinces to work side by side with the provinces in delivering on the pilot, because the provinces need capacity to be able to translate a national policy into action on the ground. If you want something to be uniform across the country, you have to have change agents that have a common vision, that have a common view, that are dedicated to go and ensure that that policy is actually implemented on the ground. And national departments could be given the responsibility under Schedule 7 grant, Schedule 7 grant, to go and work with the provinces in order to translate that policy or pilot on the ground, because a lot of people that are in the provinces are struggling to understand, you know, this policy. Few things before I finish, they're almost coming to the end. It's a plan that I've set up for the National Insurance Fund in the policy phase. Statement in the green paper. The green paper says that by 2014, when they have established the National Fund, they have appointed a CEO of the fund, as a staff, they will establish the governance structure, and they will establish the administrative system. In order for them to be able to do this, I think they need funding in order to establish a shared operational unit of the NHI fund, which is capacitated and resourced to undertake the curriculum work in readiness of the NHI. And that operational unit could identify the skills requirements for the NHI fund, ensure the capacity building and specific development activities are undertaken to ensure availability of skills when the student qualified NHI fund is established. And the state may have to send individuals identified on this table to training in countries that have implemented similar capital in the fund. So there has to be some very concrete action that is taken to prepare for the establishment of the NHI fund in 2014. And this is what is supposed to be done. The other thing that needs to be done is the evaluation of pilots. There are 10 pilots that have been set up, and pilots that have been set up in 10 districts. The Minister of Health has been going around the provinces and visiting the pilot sites to assess the progress made so far, to evaluate the readiness of facilities and the challenges being faced, as well as to ensure that the National Insurance Pilot District is on par in terms of planning and implementation. Now, this qualitative assessment needs to be supplemented with a quantitative assessment. You know, why the minister is good is getting personal experience in the case of readiness is really fantastic, and that's really that we afford it. There is a need to supplement them with a quantitative systematic evaluation of the pilot to identify the lessons that are learned and the adjustments that are needed in the design of our child. Now, let's conclude by giving some recommendations on way forward. To ensure that the adequate preparation of the health system for NHI will require the finalization of the white paper and ensuring public participation through the use of public media so that information is very out there for public communication to engage with it. And this would really help the public when the document comes to Parliament. They'll be very much aware of what this entire policy is all about. Secondly, is the finalization of the implementation plan. But that has to be based on the final white paper. So the plan to come out until after the final white paper is actually being unwritten. And the plan is the one that will give more details in terms of operational details as to, you know, what is expected at each level of health service. And then we, as I indicated, we set up a recommendation to set up a shared unit of the NHI to drive any health implementation on a daily basis. That is most important because you can't create an institutional infrastructure at the same time that you are delivering services. So you need a team that really leads and brings NHI. And then establish an NHI fund, even if the fund initially comes only from government. It's necessary to establish it outside of the Department of Health, but reporting to the Minister of Health. And that is in line with the green paper, you know, as articulated in the green paper. The next recommendation made is the drafting of the legislation based on the white paper, and that legislation obviously will take a longer route of, a custom legislation. The other major area that the Department of Health needs to do in order to improve service delivery and plan for NHI is to introduce a good information system, you know, for NHI so that the patient should be able to obtain their health record regardless of where they are in any part of the country. There has to be a centralized approach of people being able to access the medical records and at the same time be bumped up against the same affairs, you know, database to ensure that this person is updated and is entitled to receive the service from the NHI. This is a huge responsibility, and the department is busy thinking through that together with the Department of Science and Technology as well as the Department of Home Affairs. But that needs to be fast tracked. The other thing that we are recommending is developing a risk engine, which will allocate and allocate funds for this exercise. This is important. If you want to protect the funds for NHI, you actually have to have a risk engine because it's quite a lot of money we're talking about, and it requires that there be a plan on how to ensure that there's no rigging of the system, because the system can be rigged anywhere at the bottom where the person comes into a healthcare facility. They can be used to pay for things that are not being covered, you know, under the NHI. Or the funds, or the people they claim that they, or service providers they say that they saw more people than they actually saw. So basically, they need to capitalize the system. So there is a need to design a risk engine and then allocate funds and make sure that agencies such as staff work with them in managing the risk. The another issue is to add another 10 pilot districts. The green paper says that, you know, the first year there were 10 districts, the second year there were the other 10 districts. And then they were designing and testing some sub-national structure of the NHI fund. That's a provincial level, how is it going to work? It's necessary that that actually be set up. And then pilot tells the model for the integration of the public and private sector in the provision of healthcare, which will be in line with the policy that they've set up. But the thing is, in order for them to do this, they need money. The 150 million they're talking about is not going to be able to go far at all. If anything, it's not an allocation. I think it's a great limit. So this is the end of my presentation on NHI. Thank you for putting the numbers in the moment.
Well, thank you for this. If I may, I see that it's kind of a sharp criticism there.
Looking at what is the impact of the good infrastructure, or not good infrastructure and quality of education. And I think while you have a good infrastructure, you need to get an outcome from education. And that's an easy one to show. But in terms of trying to prepare for this presentation, I read all the portfolio committee notes in terms of the presentation by the Department of Equity Education. The media statement with regard to the infrastructure there as we go, or to the infrastructure and the progress and lack of progress. I had to interview a couple of people to get a sense of this. So it's a very loaded area in terms of how to present it, but I would give it a shot anyway. In fact, I even sort of said to the CEO, maybe I can come next year to them, but good results are coming in terms of the trends in international matters, science study, and we would come, really like to share those results. This is just a very loaded topic for me. So in terms of the presentation itself, I think it's the, as you said, you know, in the media presentation of the issues about schools, about non-university, if we have 400 months schools, if we have 1 month school, it is one too many. And so wouldn't the whole ambit of the 58,000 schools, and then if you look at it one level, you have 28,000, 400 schools out of 58,000, what portion is that? So if you look at it in large scale. So these are very, the issues around these voices are very loaded. And also, of course, in terms of how does one do an analysis, how does one do a presentation? Is it that we can then, what's the situation now? Or do we look at trend analysis in terms of getting a sense of how things are going to change? Again, just to say that we know all these statements about education, the inequality, things of all kinds. And in terms of trying to look at the issue of quality of education, I think we need to look at the areas of the people, the programs, and the infrastructure. And so that in terms of the youth quality of education, this is what the people issues are, you know, the quality, the programs, the curriculum, the activities, and of course the infrastructure itself. So we know that while the Department of Government has been able to introduce some policies, some infrastructure policies, and full-time policies, we also know what is important for the learning space. And so these are things that we all know about. But just because some of the information is not in some of the data itself, in terms of trying to make some of the assessment about the infrastructure, we use the Department of Education Link Database, National Education Information Management System. It is a little database, and so it's not just the basic. Now, if you look within the database and you look at infrastructure, not a basic function of infrastructure, having electricity, the water, having the attention. When it says a number of these have been, and we give an answer, it's talking to the three that have electricity. And so we can send it out to the point of view that they're consumed with no electricity, water, no water tension, no electricity, which is important exactly, and no sensing. And that's the basic kind of information machine. At the national level, it's feasible. If you look at provincial level, of course, there's an eastern case. We've got around 20, or one fifth of the students, with no electricity, no water. And since then, no reason for the world. And I think that if you look at provinces like the Eastern Cape against the region, and to just look, and there's a free state, or KwaZulu-Natal, no electricity, a quarter of schools there, and you know, one in 10 schools with no water. walking. So please take it from out of Congress, putting it in the middle of the city and we're walking. The provinces that have done things recently well, or they have two recent cases. I think we're the modern case itself and how that has been put into the and you know with the Muslim practice. And that's a sort of basic functional level. But we go another level also to the infrastructure in terms of if you want quality education, higher quality education. And we look at things like the top library. It's not just about having a town and a school, a town and a teacher, now we want a really quality education. And doing that from the interpretation of the 93% of the people have not top library. And that's a serious impact in terms of our education. So maybe we look at computers, 75% don't have that. So if we're looking at quality education, there are major shortfalls in that area, and if we're looking at function basic infrastructure, 1 in 10 schools, I think, say, is an issue in the country with provincial regulation. Then we also just looked around and it's interesting, so how we celebrate things when new things happen. And there are schools that have done very well and innovated themselves in terms of infrastructure, the solar panels, the way rainwater is collected, and mud disposals, and this mud disposal has a much better liquid. Of course, the schools in the East Coast probably know that it is a major issue. Yes, I believe Oprah Winfrey also built a common mud school, but the red country, the mud is a technology of the red country. If one looks at how they can extend itself in terms of its artificial structure, and I think we use two indicators of budget as we allocate four infrastructure and we look at saving itself in terms of the delivery. And we, as the documents show, that South Africa has committed, the government has committed well for infrastructure development with 9.17 billion having been allocated for infrastructure development. And equally, emphasizing the importance of schools, the accelerated school infrastructure development. Delivery initiative has been instituted and in terms of trying to upgrade the schools and most new levels. If you look at the board base, there has been commitments from government bodies. From a delivery base, it looks like that again 75% of the funds have been used. Which is of course, you know, if you've got funds, why don't you use it? And of course, again, what the data shows us is that for Eastern Cape, in the 2011-2012 financial year, it just used about a quarter of what was delivered or allocated to it. So, just raising the issue that, in a sense, the place that needs it the most is the place that can't use it the most. And we keep getting into these vicious cycle for trying to improve and trying to improve. And if we look at the accelerated school infrastructure initiative, again, in the figures, there was an allocation and by March 2012, only 4.5 million of the budget had been spent. Now, in terms of just trying to understand this, what constitutes an adequate infrastructure in a school and how do we evaluate it? And there's such a variation in infrastructure. If we look at the four examples here, if we look at the different kind of schools where we have these are typically South African or unique South African terms, or modern school, which is area poverty index 5, that means the density of this kind of area. They have 773 learners and then 31 classrooms, 4 offices, 1 staff room, 1 computer lab room. We have a particular profile of the school. We take another school, say school 3, which is in the homeland. It's the department in a homeless school in an urban area. We have, and this is rated as a poverty index 1 of most disadvantaged region schools. We have 915 learners and we have 18 classrooms. We take another school in the homeland and rural. Again, it's allocated a poverty index of 5, so it's a resource that says we've got 712 learners and 25 classrooms. And we see the whole look and feel of that school being different. So it raises the issue that we have such differentiated infrastructures of what then would be, and I know that the debate would be, what is the national norm for school infrastructure? Now, there has, while there's been a kind of a call for what is the national norm for the developed national norms and standards in 2008. But there has been, the call has happened and the department has started developing, but the Council of Education Ministers have taken the decision rather than going to the national norms for school infrastructure to develop a guideline on school infrastructure. And I think, again, this is a topic that go beyond this presentation at the time, but the issues of having norms and standards and indications then in terms of delivery or non-delivery and or whether one goes for guidelines and therefore use that as a way for planning after the role or planning the role. So, and then this set of guidelines have not been finalized as yet with this Council of Education Ministers. Newspaper, the legal cases in the Eastern Cape with regard to what should be delivered and what the rights of the students, etc. The other thing that is important in order for us to understand the infrastructure is the issue of a database of the infrastructure. And in 1999, the first audit was done together with the students. And then we took it into about 2008, the National Education Infrastructure Management System has been developed. And this is an ongoing system that's been developed in the department that they're trying to ensure that it becomes a live system and updated regularly. These kinds of norms and standards and having this kind of information can provide guidance for very basic indicators of adequacy and community. We need to have some sort of indicator in within the school to see what they have been delivered and what is left. And there's also, then you can look at the delivery of infrastructure and the governance regarding that. And it seems to be that the infrastructure improvement is because it's a due obligation between the department basic education and public work. And in terms of looking at this, in terms of trying to look at where is the, how do you ensure demand for it, how do you ensure accountability? We see an important part of being proper mechanisms include the circuit, district, province, public work, and therefore all of this, the acknowledgement of what needs to be done and how it should be addressed. And we would also recommend some sort of the guidelines and the guidelines for the definition that addresses or supports the guidelines to provide indicators of infrastructure, efficiency, the operational cost, maintenance, and public safety. Now, well, what then would be the kind of, some sort of recommendations there, and I want to just try to conclude with the country district way. I think the issue of the infrastructure is a very important that we highlight in the country through various programs and commitments. The issue of our school infrastructure, the strategic assist program of strategic infrastructure projects with masses of money being allocated to. And so the infrastructure for the region is vital to the development. Also find if you look globally, and I'll be trying to deal with the different issues of education, etc. The issue of infrastructure has not been as prominent. Even within the Millennium Development Goals, while it outlines the quality of education, etc., also the critiques as the analysis I'm taking now of why is it that we're not meeting the Millennium Development Goals, one of the critiques that has come out is that we didn't articulate clearly the infrastructure needs in order to deliver the quality of education. It seems that we're focusing on that aspect. So, and within science and culture, there were various infrastructure development programs. Major resources allocated to it. And again, we seem to be doing very well in terms of the policies, the plans, and the resources. And again, it seems like the great unseen that we not too well in terms of operationalizing it. And some of the issues that come up in terms of not delivering to the level that we'd like to deliver, the issues of skills and talents in the country. And furthermore, with regard to this issue about the school infrastructure that we try to understand it, one of the issues that comes up or that's articulated is that how do we understand financial reporting? And so in the interview, some people said that on paper it's terrible that 4.5% has been spent. But really, in terms of the programs itself, the work is taking place, the contract signing is placed, there is allocated money of R1 billion. And if we sort of evaluate the financial report as at the 31st of March, it looks very bad. So we need to, how then do we sort of look at this and say whether it's going to be or not going to be a sense of and how accountability happens, or how certain issues are addressed. The other issue that comes up, and I think we're discussing in the committee as well, the issue of procurement and supply chain management, and how that impedes some of the programs. It's interesting listening to the news yesterday, President Obama, don't let bureaucracy hold you up in the middle of the other. We were surprised to all the policies, but it's not going to give up with the stuff you're going to be delivering. And it is a line that we constantly have to mediate between the delivery, but you have to have it to and the bureaucratic process. The other issue that comes up in terms of the delivery is the tension between the delivery and using of local providers and using bigger package providers, and how those two are managed again in order to get the kinds of outcomes that we want. In starting off, that the interest, if we look at the SIP program and we see how that rollout takes place now and our own kind of delivery on it, but it's just that while we don't have clear answers, that we don't have in terms of the school infrastructure project, we know it's very important, and we know that the resources and the commitment to the policies and so on. But I think this gives us again, I think we need to shift into further analysis about service delivery issues and why is it that we, or how can we increase the service delivery given and working around the capacity issues, the procurement issues and the capacity issues, various other issues that one has to deal with. And so our debate needs to shift now from just the water issue to the delivery kind of issue. And I think that's where we need to have some more understanding.
Thank you.
today, I have to put people spending quite a more time up front because of the two presentations. They look like another topic. I have to go very close to the heart, which is on procreation. How do you do it or not? And specifically, the question is, which area of the continent is called the local mandate and realize most of the population. Of course, when we think of the problem of population, we have to think in terms of two things. Firstly, we have to think in terms of, I think, direct employment by state, where people work in various government departments, and then, of course, the flash programs over the last few years, linked to a variety of employment, public employment programs, ranging from the federal public work program, and then secondly would be the indirect way to government and how with employment creation, and here we specifically refer to pro-poor economic policies or pro-growth economic policies. Specifically, for one of these examples would be the current residential infrastructure initiative. That would be considered an indirect pro-growth intervention from the state. Evaluating all these different types of interventions is rather complex and will keep us with the ideas for the whole day. So we are going to give you just a snapshot. Obviously, it's a great job. In the current context, you have to take into consideration both the global context as well as the South African context. So what is the global context for job creation today? We have a weakening of South African economy, especially, following 2008. And then we've had a couple of interventions, specifically some kind of fiscal stimulus package that got into the South African economy. But we still need to bear in mind that the global economy has weakened considerably, and that was, I think, the main message in the statement by the minister last week on the 20th of October. And here, if we look across the world, the four or five main regions of the world, main trading partners, South Africa, we find this weakening in economic performance. The European Union is stagnating. The United States, there is tremendous uncertainty, but there is a strong move towards slow, very, very slow economic growth and probably also the ability to some kind of recession for a brief period. And then the slow development in the global sun engines of growth, referred to a few years ago, China and India, is also a great and tremendous concern. Opportunities in tariff are slightly better, but Africa's growth in also not as certain as what we expected a few years ago. If we turn to the domestic context, then we have, I think, a much longer list than what we have up front in terms of global concerns and domestic concerns. But firstly, I think that up front is the area of industrial dispute, the recent ongoing strike specifically in the mining sector, the lowering and weakening of business confidence, lowering the levels of public or private investment as a result of global slowdown behind in the global public or private investment FDI inflows, and also another spillover effect, of course, is that when global growth slows, the demand for African commodities will slow down, therefore our exports will tend to contract as well. And at the same time, we've had a slight level of maintenance of fiscal stability in South Africa and the PIPC or PI intervention that President Mustafa. And we've got to try and capitalize on that. Now, taking a closer look and referring to the first equation that set out, that growth, how economic growth really happens and how it can help with job creation, is this the anticipated growth, I think, 7-8 months ago or last year was roughly 3.1-3.2%, then it came down to 2.7%, and now at 2.5%. And with the accelerated global slowdown, I think we might even come down to 2.1% soon. Of course, the rating agency situation also, as the minister pointed out, didn't help us a good deal. Now, what's the consequence of slow growth? A key spillover effect of slow growth is you have lower revenue, so lower tax.
slow growth also triggers, I think, limited opportunities for job creation. And these limitations cut across all the different component sectors of the economy. In the private sector, we've got slowdown. In the public sector, we've got slowdown. And we now questioning whether we'll be able actually to reach some of the new rolling up targets, which are of course slightly shorter than what you've anticipated in the actual development plan. But we've had a glimmer of hope. We've got the kind of glimmer of hope in the public works programs. But once again, slow growth, low taxes, will we be able to sustain public works programs? Job growth in public works avenue. Now, it is against this background that the minister has put forward a very prudent budget and highlighted that the global and local context compelled him to make a couple of very tough decisions. The real increase in spending has been, I think, capped to about 2.9% a year. It's mainly going to translate into a slightly higher government spending. But we are not slipping into the European context of tough fiscal austerity, although I think we can expect a few cuts in government jobs. We minor, very, very minor shifts in expenditure areas of health, education, roads, public works, and as I said, these are either direct or indirect opportunities for job creation. But there will also be a very strong emphasis in improving the quality of spending. How do we plan the variety of projects? How, you know, we organize and arrange government procurement from the right private businesses, and of course the management of government expenditure. Now, going forward, what I think we are really planning for higher spending, specifically in the area of infrastructural investment and improving the economic competitiveness of South Africa. But there's also been, I think, improvement in or at least maintaining the so-called social wage, because it's very broad and going beyond this, what we call social grant. Social wage is not equal to social grant. It's that social wage relates to all sorts of public spending items to support social delivery. But this but budgeting is a balancing act, that we all know. So while you can lose something on the one hand, on the other hand, you've got to contract it, you've got to do giving at the expense of other expenditure items. Specifically, administrative costs will have to be reduced. And we've got to, of course, curb a little bit public employment. Here, specifically, what level of increases above CPI will be able to tolerate even the global and the local context. So what are the implications now for short-term job creation? Now, the end of strong growth in public sector employment over the last decade, I think that is something that we will have to live with, that's a phenomenon that we have to definitely have to live with. Although we expect modest improvement in the private sector abroad, there are a variety of other factors that will bear on that. So therefore, key sectors, I think, will still be your two main service sectors, retail and tourism, as well as improvement probably in construction. Now, of course, the construction spillover, or the injection of the construction growth of jobs, will largely be driven by the public infrastructure investment. The main areas of job growth will be in public works, and in the public works we have, of course, two main areas of intervention, mainly around environmental programs, working for water and so on, as well as what have we done and what do we expect to happen within the medium term? There will definitely be the increase in infrastructure and construction employment. A little bit of increase in agriculture. I mean, we have in agriculture the last year or so. And then probably slightly construction as well. But these will all be spillover. The second round effect is a result of improved And then we will definitely in the service-related sectors, specifically tourism and business services, be expecting increases. On the gain, and second round effect on infrastructure related. However, we are leaving, we want to leave the committee with a few areas of concern. What we might have here as question marks. How do you stimulate stronger employment growth in the short term? Yesterday, the news of the census was not good news at all. 30% unemployment. Can we only rely on public works? How long will it take for the investment in infrastructure to trickle down into employment? We have great uncertainties on the employment intensity of our growth. The growth at 2.5% and expected to come down with a global slowdown to 1%. The employment intensity or the employment absorption of growth is definitely going to be a challenge. There is an unclear relationship in our industrial relations, how the private sector relates to the labor union, and this is an area I think that's quite beyond the mandate of the committee, but it's certainly an institutional dynamic that will bear on employment creation. We are a bit concerned about the big elephant in the room. If we think of that as a youth employment, what are we really doing about employment opportunities for young people? Now, we know that jobs fund received some kind of rejection of 5 to 5 billion over the medium-term framework, but what clarity do we have in terms of what actually happening in practice? So these are question marks that we leave as areas for recommendations and further work. We're going to talk to another question, I guess.
Yeah.
I'd love to move on to the next area. I was requested to leave the infrastructure to this. Okay. So I will go on over to my favorite topic.
I don't have a slide on the PowerPoint, but there has been a document which has been circulated, and if I can draw your attention to that. And make two very good points. I mean, the issues have been raised around issues of infrastructure here this morning. But also that in the medium-term budget, policy statement last week, the minister did this waiver from his commitment to ensuring that there would be continued spending and to grow the economy. And I think that, you know, in that regard, obviously, that is something which is good. Yesterday, we had a census data, which was also released, which people also refer to, and that, again, made some rather depressing news. Let me grant big ideas of the 2012 budget. Hasn't rollout of large infrastructure projects, and that has been as an attempt to kickstart both growth and unemployment. But I think that one of the most important points that we want to make about this is that this strategy has to reaffirm government's commitment to creating economic linkages between communities, and this might be a fundamental point. The National Development Plan raises it. It talks about strong leadership. It talks about assets moving and an effective government to improve the country's future. The question, of course, is also, as the new growth path, and here I'm on page 2, talks about creating 5 million jobs in various sectors and markets. The thing that we need to be thinking of is we need to be thinking of the planning, the implementation, and the monitoring of these infrastructure projects. So how are we going to plan, implement, and monitor the 845 billion rand that has been allocated for infrastructure spending? And here I think we have an opportunity for Parliament to actually exercise its oversight role and also to be a champion of local economic development. Because despite all of this, we have seen that over years there have been problems and challenges with regard to infrastructure development, whether it's inadequate investment levels, whether it's weak implementation capacity, whether it's particularly at local government level, where we talk about significant delays and cost overruns, poor project planning, we've seen and the misalignment of some of these strategic projects with local national priorities, poor coordination amongst government agencies. Particularly, obviously, national, provincial, and local. And so how will government respond to that? One of the responses has been the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee, PICC. And I'll have to be more skeptical and say, well, yet another agency, yet another coordinating commission. But one of the key things about the PICC is that it's supposed to look at both monitoring and accountability of these large-scale projects, and looking at ways in which one can empower local people to, in fact, benefit from these large-scale infrastructure projects. And the PICC does acknowledge that we need to get away from a fractured way of dealing with infrastructure. We need coherence, we need collaboration, and we need to remove the barriers which stand in the way of greater monitoring, evaluation, and accountability. And we need less waste, less inefficiency, more financial discipline. So after all of that, I think the two brief points that I want to make is one is that infrastructure development can be an effective way of lifting millions of people out of poverty. It's one of the key economic pillars of the new administration, and it needs to be supported. But what that means is this kind of growth, for growth to be inclusive, you need a participatory element in it. So that it is creating the economic linkages between communities. It is that growth and the benefits of that is pushing down. They're pushing down to local communities. And what that means is that this is not just about big business securing contracts. It's rather that the local communities, in fact, are involved directly in some of this planning and in the participatory element of it. The Constitution, as we all know, has a representative element and a participatory element. But what we've seen in South Africa recently is that participatory element seems to be questioned. We don't seem to know how to include people in a critical and meaningful way. And what that results in is it results in the social indecision and social conflict that we've seen in many of our communities. So the growth really and results in development, we need to link this to what citizens actually accept. If there's going to be a road, if there's going to be transport in their area, they need to know what that means for them. Is it going to benefit them? Is it where they want the road? And so, in one of the pilot studies which the HSRC has done, 3 best practices in studies in South Africa, and then also in China, these results relate to South Africa. If what was found was that on issues of infrastructure development, is that the vast discrepancies existed between the residents' perception of the public participation process and whether they'd be included in that, and also the quality and the efficacy of the mechanisms for actually getting people's voices to be heard. And more often than not, people thought that the engagement wasn't really meaningful, that ex-representative businesses had with citizens. And that resulted in citizens simply having a lack of knowledge or interest in what was happening around them in their community. They didn't feel that they were consulted, they wasn't informed after the fact. And even though there was a scope for public-private partnership and engagement with local NGOs, for those with seen as being also effective tools for service delivery, that there were limited skills and capacity
and to put a municipality with services which weren't their core competency. So the need that we have in South Africa is to create these good livelihoods with urgency, and often that results in us taking shortcuts, whether it's in terms of green economy or in terms of participation by communities. But I think that one of the things that Parliament as a whole can do, and this committee in particular, and it's not just look at the numbers, it's also to look at issues of accountability within the third and large-scale program and extensive participation. Because certainly, I think it's not that we need to reset the button on a kind of multi-stakeholder approach to participation, which in this case includes government, communities, and also businesses and various spatial nodes. Because I think what we need to move beyond is we need to move beyond this idea of citizens as being passive recipients of government largesse, but rather that citizens are active participants in creating democratic communities. And this requires mind shift for people, for all of us, I think, in particularly creative and plan. And so how do we though, I think the last point I wanted to make is how do we then ensure that there is there is accountability and transparency at every level of the infrastructure development process. How do citizens get value for money out of that process? And how do we ensure that what is rolled out is in fact what is necessary, but also that local communities benefit because there's no corruption? And we know that corruption is also one of the issues which undermine many of these things that we've been talking about this morning with regard to the budget, is that sometimes times don't happen because of corruption. So what is the way in which one can do this, and I'm really encouraging new parliamentarians also to be champions of this, is the Construction Sector Transparency Initiative, which is a global initiative with a very simple goal, and that is to ensure that publicly financed construction projects, that those are realized and the public gets the gets value for money. And the ACRC, through my view, that we've been having some preliminary discussions with COST. The website is on the document. And about how we can be involved and be a research partner to them on issues of construction sector transparency. Because it is about local communities, it is about services. The South African government last week went to Africa and launched a COST program. And the Ministry of Public Works was there, and hopefully there will be champions in the government who are able to champion transparency in the construction sector. It's a simple formula. The way in which it works is that information is gathered, it's verified, and it's given to the public about large-scale infrastructure projects. So you can hold government to account for what is in common, so that there's limited corruption, because we all have information. We are able to hold and the government to account. It also, what is interesting about the project is that it allows for this multi-stakeholder process. So it is about the construction sector, but it is also about government, about local communities, about civil society, research institutions, all doing this to ensure that local communities can have benefits. It has been rolled out in a number of countries and pilot countries. And so hopefully we can create something of a gold standard for South Africa so that we don't have a situation where these big infrastructure projects, the only people who benefit are large contractors, and at the worst end of scale are people who are corrupt and connected and to those in power. So at the heart of this really is a multi-stakeholder approach to try to forge a consensus across the different partnerships about what exactly and is needed about procurement. And so I think lastly, while we know that there are concerns about the potential for corruption and how that might contaminate any one of the plans which the ministries have around infrastructure and development. And we know recently that there have been concerns about public tendering. And so this idea of we get better value plans, we might not be able to solve the difficult problems of the census showed us yesterday, the intractable challenges. But what we can do is we ensure that there is greater value to money, so that when money has been allocated, that that gets spent properly and it's spent to the benefit of citizens. And
the Minister of Finance talks about waste and inefficiency a lot. But for transparency to happen, value for money to happen, what you need is a new champion. Outside of government, within government, and certainly within Parliament. So I think that one of the things that, while we might be depressed about the numbers, while the budget isn't getting any bigger, it's shrinking. What we can do, I think, a major part of this is about improving things, is if we cut the waste and inefficiency. And that is about greater accountability, about greater transparency. And that's what we all do something about. So my point is simply to urge you to look at the cost website, but also to be tracking very carefully those contracts, those tenders that are going out, and to see where the local communities, the economic linkages are being hit, and local communities and citizens are involved, have participated, and therefore benefit. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the rural areas, how can expense be improved to obtain the best outcomes in regard to rural development? Now, to just go back and remind ourselves of our context a little bit, we've had a new growth path, main focus emphasis was on agriculture as the engine for rural development, more specifically focusing on creating 300,000 smallholder farmers and expanding employment. However, if we compare it to results presented in the last budget, then we are really off track. The target to establish new smallholders was reduced actually by 50% from 10,000 to 5,000 to the next 10% from the around even lower. So it's not impressive. I don't know why that's true, and I'm sure that we are thinking about how to change that reality. Now, in addition to that, to begin the conversation, we are also aware of two main guiding policy frameworks or statements. Essentially, the outcome 7, which stipulates 5 specific outputs for rural development, as well as the land reform green paper. Now, I will refer also to the comprehensive rural development program as we go along. In the interest of time and focus on the key content of my presentation, I'd love to move on to the actual budget information that came out of the medium term budget policy statement last week. Now, interestingly, we have an increase in the allocation for these two main departments in charge of rural development, both Department of Rural Development and Land Reform and Contract Culture. They received slight increases in terms of the investment. The Department of Rural Development allocated a little bit extra money, about 96.5 million, and the Department of Agriculture 7.1 million. However, in the Department of Rural Development, we have substantial changes in the internal reallocation of funds, especially towards in favor of what's called current payments. And the question mark is actually that aims at improving capacity in that department. In other words, you're giving a department a lot of money, but its ability to implement programs and really exert some positive impact on the livelihoods of people, it depends essentially on its capacity, its ability to deliver. And so I am questioning whether that was really the objective of shift around the money within the medium-term budget policy statement with regard to the Department of Development and Land Reform. Now, of course, we now know that the total allocations for these two partners is no more or less in Europe of 15 billion, and that this allocation is basically in favor of the rural development in the order of 9 billion and the other partners in the order of 6 billion. Now, the patching program in the rural development work in South Africa remained the comprehensive rural development program, and there was a review conducted of this comprehensive rural development program in around August, and there was a last year, and the results came out in August after 2.5 years overdue. And it focused on basically two different phases. The first phase of the CRDP implementation was simply about trying to understand what is really happening in rural areas. What are the livelihood conditions of people like in rural areas? And they accumulated or collected a huge amount of information. What the sad part is that the old integrated sustainable rural development nodes, they're still there. In other words, the areas that we initially targeted way back in 2008 for strong investment from the side of the public sector to improve the lives of those people, those areas are still there. So the 23 new presidential nodes in those areas, they basically, expanded or inflated, integrated sustainable rural development nodes, inflated by the RDP nodes. But that's what is a concern. Why would you have an inflation of nodes if you had investment in these areas to improve people's livelihoods way back in 2008? Rural communities are food insecure and vulnerable to socioeconomic and household food insecurity. The second phase of the CRDP, which is beginning in or should be in progress, is an area broadly defined as so-called enterprise development. And it's mainly focused basically for sustainable job creation and to develop enterprises in rural areas, and small enterprises in rural areas. Two of these particular interventions I want to highlight. One is upscale household food production, and it's been a considerable amount of training of people for vegetable production for the aid of the Agricultural Research Council. As I raised in the previous, my previous presentation, it's technical support and not dealing with some of the social and human aspects, which I think only the aid machine probably would be able to do properly. Now, in terms of institutional arrangements, there's also been established what is called now the 22 councils of stakeholders spread across the nine provinces. And these basically councils in local areas, and they consist of representatives from communities, the public, and private sector partners dealing with a variety of different interventions. Now, it is hard at this stage to establish the effectiveness of these as they part of phase two, which is really the enterprise development. So the enterprise development project is really going to be more participatory. It's not going to be something that is just from up top there and going to be pushed on the community. Whether this is going to be effectively implemented in rural areas, we have to wait and see. It's working closely. The other flagship program at the moment is National Rural Youth Service Force. Okay? Now this is an interesting intervention, and our concern is it is not clear whether NARITEC is really a stakeholder training scheme for young people to enable them to enter the employment market, or whether NARITEC is really a public employment scheme, or some weird combination of the two, some hybrid scheme for the youth. We just don't know. We've offered a considerable amount of help up until now to the NARITEC unit offers, and at the moment they're linking in to other spending programs within the department. What is interesting, of course, is that they have managed to incorporate at least get 7,400 young people trained through the program, although we don't know about the transition from the training into the job market in rural areas. That's because we don't know yet. What is worrying is that in the last 6 months, since the last budget, we've only had about 1,500 people trained through the NARITEC program. That is confirmed the biggest in the medium term about the policy statement. If we come specifically to land reform has now shifted in South Africa away from our land and so forth, with the Land Redistribution by Agriculture Development Program, to what is now called the Proactive Land Redistribution Program, Proactive Land Redistribution Program. Now, in this new approach to land redistribution, the emphasis is placed on the state acquiring farmland and then leasing to land reform beneficiaries. All land grants have now been discontinued and, of course, replaced by the by PLAS or PLAS, And what is actually happening at the moment is that our application pipeline is still being finalized. There is considerable amount of confusion in rural areas at the moment. I am in the process of my team, we are writing up a study that we have just completed, complete field work, and it's very, very confusing what is really happening. People don't know what's happening. And I'll just give you one example, as a result of PLUS. Now PLUS is harmed only to individuals, and you've got to complete to get the harm. I've gone to the board, Eden Blue area, for example, and I asked, well, what's the list of people coming to your office, or give me a list of people coming to your office applying for land. Now, in the current period, they have more than 52 applicants for land. They only have 3 farms to allocate in the current financial period. 3 farms to individual farmers. Now, that's the confusion at the moment with regard to land reform. Now, all the land, all the money are now going towards the LAS program, and the concern for what is the steep decline in the number of land reform beneficiaries, and I've already the example on research that we are writing up at the moment of the area. This is a program aimed at helping those so-called American treaty often refers to this as a collapsed project. They're not really collapsed projects. But the project in distress, that's the a term that we want to use in order not to depress people further. And what it aims basically to do is to help these projects in distress, land reform beneficiaries, having difficulty in upscaling and improving the optimal productive utilization of land, give them assistance, some kind of assistance similar to the comprehensive agricultural support package. And there are basically two areas. The one is they deal with the funding, how to manage the funding through a rural cooperative center, which is not really set up yet, but it's in a pipeline, a socialized financial support system scheme to land reform beneficiaries or in distress. And it aims to resuscitate deep-ground farms and 2,300 more farms. Current year's target is 460, was 416, but in the last 6 months, they've only reached 83 farms. Now, if you go based on historical performance within the department, it will likely be another, 60 or 50 or 60 farms. So they're way below the current target for the current year. Let me go to the board. It's a much broader program. It's about rural infrastructure development. What is happening in the area of rural infrastructure development? Now, there's a lot of stuff happening in rural infrastructure development. Very, very fragmented, very, very disappointed, and not really coordinated by the chief of the department. And that's a key area for us in terms of recommendation. It's got to be, in line with outcome 7, closer coordination between the two departments responsible for outcome 7. Department of Rural Development and Department of Agriculture. Now, in the former Homer area, it's basically about reviving and revitalization of old, irrigation schemes. Now, that is not sufficient to help small farmers struggling in those areas. But then, of course, there is also at the right side really, where there's been improvement in access to, ICT, information communication technology, recent technology infrastructure, telecommunications, rural schools. There is, for example, the iSchool Africa program has been rolled out to 13 schools within the DRC site. However, why is it that it's only rolled out to 13 schools across the DRC site? Why is it a limited rollout if you think in terms of bringing these schools into the modern world, modern knowledge economy? Why not more schools? Why only 13 schools? We can't find clear answers to that. Very important infrastructure. There's also been an initiative called Rural Town Development based on green principles. And there are now a whole range of kind of dotted all over the country. What's going to be the outcome of that? We don't know. But of course, largely driven by COP 17, event last year. Then, the Department of Agriculture specifically is trying to tap into coordinating the rural infrastructure and agro-logistics component of the presidential infrastructure initiative. And there are a whole range of different, I can give a couple of details on agro-logistics programs. The question here is, how are these linked to smallholder farmers and the rural poor? The support for agricultural development support, ADA, for small farmers remains very, very, very limited. In fact, we have to say, to begin a process of where we want to document in greater detail where these smallholder farmers are, how many we have in South Africa. At the moment, we're working on ballpark figures about 3.1 million small farm households across South Africa. Now, only 2.2 to 2.7 million of these households have a survey evidence that they are engaged in some kind of agricultural production. Now, what the Department of Agriculture is doing and the Department of Rural Development from time to time is trying to increase agriculture investment. Now, that's a very interesting program, a good program. In simple terms, it means decentralizing the processing into rural areas. In other words, instead of having a maize factory in Cape Town, the maize or flour mill will be closer into the rural areas. A lot of other and smaller work that not only in job creation, but also in terms of indexing. Now, the job creation aspect of rural development is still relying quite heavily on the community work program, and I've raised some of the concerns around that already in the previous at the same time, it's partially as a result of, we all know the Walmart situation. Now, in order to link smallholders to agro-food value chain, there's now been an investigation for learning, trying to learn lessons from other parts of the world on the Walmart direct farm procurement program. Specifically, there's been a visit recently to Costa Rica to learn about the successes of the program in Costa Rica to link smallholder farmers to markets. Now, this is a depressing part, but if you look at the tail end, there is simply slight improvement, and that's about in the order of about 30,000 jobs we've had in the last year. Now, I have updated this is a year based on the formulaic portion, and we haven't used census yet, because we are going to get the raw data of the census to plot them back into this year. It's not very, very lonely at all. We are worried about agricultural development support to smallholder farmers. There's very poor quality statistics coming from the respective departments. We are still relying quite heavily on the General Household Survey for this. These numbers are not consistent with administrative data. That's what we know now. And we know absolutely nothing about the impact of the agricultural development support packages on the livelihoods of people in rural areas. And that's what's a concern. We, of course, constantly support the recent launch of the draft food security policy and of the massive interventions into the zero hunger strategy. What's interesting about this development is that we're beginning to rethink our plans for food security in South Africa. Okay? But there is still very limited emphasis on access to food within the economy and more on food production. Now, this is a depressing picture of the food security situation 3 years after the food security crisis, the global food price crisis, and based on our analysis of the pricing data coming from Reserve Bank, as well as inflationary data, we are currently passing through what we now term the third wave of rapid food price inflation. We are in the middle of it at the moment, and we are still struggling to get out of the effect or the impact of the second wave that happened 3 years ago, typically 3 years ago. So at the moment we have more than a fifth of South African households struggling to purchase and buy food that they require, not even referring to quality of food, which is what colleagues of mine in the other unit of the public health unit, what they are doing, looking at dietary accuracy, nutrition, which is an important issue with major health consequences, and I think the Minister has been reminding us of that from time to time. The Minister, what's your name? my plea, my goal, is we've got to budget for effective rural development away from the scattered rural development budgeting that is happening at the moment. If we want to achieve the outputs of outcome number 7, we have to budget for effective rural development. So what does it entail? Public investment in rural development now stands at $15 billion, but it is less than 2% of the total national budget. According to the Maputo Declaration, signed South African recently, to them, in 2003, it should be 10%. When are we going to get there? The median budget term budget policy statement gave this particular domain of air and analysis $170 billion. But it's logical to enable the Department of Rural Development to implement the program. It is necessary for the department to streamline and prioritize the program and then be more effective. Now, of course, we support the new draft food security policy. It's heading in the right direction, but there is a need for strong emphasis on household food access in the context of increasingly expensive food. In other words, policy allocation must shift toward making good quality food more affordable, investment in local agri-food markets, and food price subsidies for low-income families. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Are we going to separate them or we just you zoom into Inua. Okay. Anabhat.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for a very good presentation by all three presenters, and you know, this is really informative. My first problem is that if I want to start a business and start up a factory, I do planning and I, you know, find out what the land's going to cost me and what the factory is going to cost me and how many people I'm going to employ and all sorts of planning. Now, with National Health Insurance, we don't seem to do that. We have to seem to have pilot projects. And then I'm afraid we're going to find ourselves in a situation later on. We're going to find that we won't be able to afford it. So what my question to you is, has the HSRC done any calculation as to what the total cost of the full introduction in NHA will be to the country? The second thing is now to education. The situation with regard to education is speaking about the quality of education. Now, a few years ago, if you had, you know, a Model C school, you would have had a situation where if they get an average of, say, 9, 10 A's, you know, in that school, they would be jumping over the moon, they'd be so pleased. Now they get 70, 80 average A's. And my, you know, I can only derive from that that the quality of the content of the syllabus is reduced something horribly. And this is why we're finding in the news this week that the universities, in fact, are now forming their own body to check whether people are ready for university. You know, I hear your, when you talk about the quality of schools, et cetera, and that they should be upgraded, and I agree with that. And that will go some way towards helping that. But what does it help if we have all the wonderful facilities, but, you know, the content of the syllabus is not good enough? That is my second question. The third goes to agriculture. I will just make a statement about that and not ask a question. Just to say that small-scale farming, I'm not surprised that it's reduced from 10 to 5,000 because it's never going to work. It's something, it is a fact of life. The bigger the farms, the better you are able to ensure food security and the better you're able to you know, have economies of scale in production. So, you know, I don't know. It's not going to work.
I'm not a devotee. It's never going to work.
Thanks. I also want to say, maybe the
The way they address us, Chair, and the way they gave us the information, thanks for that. My question is actually, because I like agriculture and like rural development, I'm from that area, so I want to ask firstly if it's possible that we can have this report. Because it is for me this morning when I think we need to look at this agency because there are some things that sound for me isn't good for us. The second thing, I want to ask him if they looked at that Pala scheme. You know the Pala scheme was in the 1940s, 50s, and that was one of the success stories when it comes to farming in South Africa. I think it was 10 hectares per person. They provide the machinery, but one tractor, say, for 100 farmers or for 50 farmers. And that wild guy, that is a success story. I spoke with Mr. Lequinti one other time about it. And I think if we can have, say, 1,000 hectares, say, for 100 farmers, and say, listen, okay, we will assist you with practice, and we will be there. 1 week we come through late. I think that is that we must urgently look at this. We were in this country. And in case it's there. And there are a lot of plants that are lying. I think productive plants. And my view is, I think if we can look at this and put this in practice, I think then we are on the right track. We are now busy for the last few years, and let me be honest, three or four farms. It is actually not success. And there must be an urgent turnaround on this thing. I have no doubt about this. Then, if you look when we were in I was lucky, I was 2 times in China. They have big farms and successful farms. Now that is actually also on, I think that's also a program that I think we must investigate, because we sit here with a lot of people who haven't got the skills, but in this division they can be masters. In other words, you may not have the academic qualifications, but if you go to visit these people, they will tell you, I'm a professional farmer, I'm a professional person in agriculture, and I think that is what we must actually look on. So I heard down here and I heard what Dr. Jake say. But and then the thing of this, we will never succeed if we only have 2% of your budget for agriculture. Never. We have to increase this amount. So what must we do? Was we would put pressure from our side, from our agriculture. But then the answer on the other side is, what is the success of the agriculture? So I think we must come with a plan that is easy implementable, if I can put it like this. And my request this morning, you know, up and now, is that do we have a success implementable plan that's easy understandable? One of the big problems, unfortunately, is, Dr. Hugh mentioned what and I also heard it on television yesterday evening, if you're a small farmer, and if you have problems of droughts or anything, the biggest challenge for them is to go from one office to another office all the time. And I also mentioned 3 years ago when I arrived there, when I was in that country. The big problem that comes to doctor, I think you will know, is the red tape for other people. They don't have the skills. You know, in some of them, you have to say, well, I'm not going to do this. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges we have to address. And perhaps I think if you can come with some proposals in that regard, that we can negate. Because if you look at the plan that was put by Mr. Manuel and Dr. Karan, that is the generator. And then the other thing, that there is one thing short in this whole thing. You might have entrepreneurs in the agriculture field also. Because not necessarily only to create jobs, but you learn the entrepreneurs. So I want to hear what your view on this. The few things that I mentioned here. But otherwise, if you look at this 50% down, this is about 600,000, and it's just going down. And that is actually what agriculture is actually economic generator, if I can put it like this. But I think we must actually look at the farmland scheme. We must see why was that in a success recipe? And we can use that. We should check with, I gave certain farms papers. These farms are still up to 2002, 20 years. They are standing in the garage. Why not? Because they didn't have someone, you could track it to a person who don't even have license to drive the car. That is the point. And I think that is why you've got 40 tractors hanging from Malanga and a certain place, nothing happened with it. Don't ask money, give a person, listen for the next 6 months, I will be with you, I will help you to plow your hands. But don't give a person just a tractor, so now you carry on. You can't expect only from this person to make a success. And you come back to the mentoring process. We don't have mentors. If you don't have mental education or in other situations, then you have not. And that's my view that I think agency must be much more practical instead of theoretical. And that is the problem that I think that is the biggest challenge for us in agriculture. And another thing, perhaps extension officers. Extension officers, I'm sorry to say that, we have 2 or 3 child extension officers. How many of them are genuine? Or are they just in the post? Don't have experience. Extension officers are a success story in other countries to provide information and to lead them into positions what they must do. And I think the quality of our extension officers, that is a problem. And that is that, sorry to raise that, but I think we have to put emphasis on that. Don't give a person to the other and just walk away. What is the report? Do we get reports from them back? Don't they only need 24,000 visits? What is the success rate here of that 24,000 visits? What is at the end of the day, the outcome of that 24,000 visits? And I think in this regard, we have to look at it.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thank you, Honorable Plum. Honorable
thank you, Chairperson, and thanks for your presentation. It's very important. I'll just go to education because last year we approved an adjustment for ACID and it clearly never assisted. But the problem is when it came to this many implementing agencies, are they really assistance? Because we think that we should also be focusing, because you know these are agencies which are within the government department, like DBSA, which is doing everything. The department will tell you to DBSA about all the schools, and it's not only this department, other departments which make up out their capacity. And also have Mvula and DTI, or IDT, which we think there are so many. And here you saw a good, positively referred to what you also think should be happening in the Department of Basic Education and Public Works. Do we really need all these implementing agents if when they are there, we still don't see any program, and what financial impact does it cause? Because from last year when we were very questionable about approving that adjustment, then we were promised that the school seat would be there because of all these tools that were available. We didn't achieve them. And when it comes to saying the schools, in the presentation of Ms. There's a lot of reference to communities and their involvement. I think when we involve communities, we can even involve them through projects. There's some things that they can do. Can we link some things that will give us some ability to say this is there? Because we know we have those powers to guide the budget and the performance of the department. If we link all these projects that can reduce the expenditure through labor-intensive programs, won't it assist us in achieving this number of schools that have been set? And we don't see any, we know the programs because they say a school was completed here and there. But it's tangible and things that we can see, that we can change maybe the approach that is used by the department by bringing together these issues and at the same time addressing job creation somehow, like maybe community making bricks or some whatever the community involvement can result into. I think that will really help us if we can know the role of these implementing agents and what positive impact it has when we refer to the project, because there's a lot of money that goes away before a real job is being done. Can't we change the focus of this ICT program? Because we really want to see public works doing something about it. And the subject of the grants in all this food security, land, rural development, and Department of Agriculture, don't we have many grants that we can streamline to address specific issues that we can see some progress and maybe at the end of the day get some output out of this outcome service. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thanks, Chair. Mind on education. I just want to speak on the effective learning space. which for me would be an effective learning entity. I say this step because I just want to check and understand more on what I will call the contextual factor. That the learning space also is related to the infrastructure. I'm checking this because on the bullet that says the bullet, I don't know, on page 3, on the last slide, it is clear that it is said that an adequate infrastructure creates a conducive learning environment. I remember that at some stage there was a tool that was called IQMS, which was a tool to evaluate teachers, whereby somewhere on the performance indicators, one of the things that was indicated that it also contributes to a poor teaching and learning situation, on also picking up on the issue of contextual factors on the learning space, learning and teaching space. What also I want to check is when you speak of students, pupil-teacher ratio in the classroom, are you able as this structure to get some of the information that will also be able to contribute on the weaknesses so that at least we are able to say what exactly does the government need to address I want to bring the point that says it also contributes to poor results at the end of the time of the year. I will also want to draw you to make this example that when you speak of this land space, you have a situation where you have on the pupil teacher ratio, you have a classroom where you have combined two groups, two teachers, because we're speaking of pupil teacher ratio. There are two teachers equal to the pupil. As a distribution, but the challenge therefore becomes the space that is a contribution of infrastructure. Now I'm relating this to this issue of asset to say the contextual factor that I want to raise from you to check whether you have any other thing that you are able to recommend in that area is the fact that it's the issue of land. I was actually bringing an example that said two teachers are combined in one classroom, two groups of learners. There is no space. You further take it to where you say the department is ready to improve, to upgrade. I want to bring the element of asset in that regard. That when you speak of asset, you speak about building, replacing, and upgrading schools. Schools that have those weaknesses, those challenges in terms of the space. Department now is ready to upgrade or to improve. Now the challenge I want to bring is the issue of land. I don't know whether I'm clear what I'm trying to raise. The issue of land in the school. Those schools, more especially, that were built long time ago, you know, where parents in the communities were just doing their own thing, you know, they will identify a space and then build. They did not have by then anything that tells them on what exactly the effective school needs to be. Because I'm raising this because in a number of schools in rural areas, even if the department is now ready to upgrade, but they have those challenges. I'll make you an example. One of the schools in my constituency this year, it has been allocated, I understand, 10 or 12 million to be upgraded. Because of that thing that I was also mentioning, that you have in grade 1, 6 teachers, in a hall that extra is made to accommodate only 3 groups, classes, but now there are 6, 2 the extra, all of them. Now, the department is ready to go then upgrade with some other classes to also actually address that particular challenge. But when the money has been appropriated to do that particular function, they can't move. They've done everything, but the factor is there is no space, there is no land. for the school to be, you know, to be upgraded into what we would expect the school to be, either in regard to the norms and standards, but they can't move. It's closed. It's just that. And the other thing, even the area, you can't, when I say you have to identify the other area, you know the areas in the rural areas, those mountainous things and so on, and I'm trying to say actually, there are some of those things that you are seated with, either whether the government is ready or not ready, but those are conjectural factors that at this moment you do not know because our societies and our communities, but you can't upgrade schools to that level. I just wanted to throw that and also, yeah.
Thanks. Mine is more a broader question, not related specifically to any of the presentations, but to try to see, with your research findings that you've made in terms of efficiencies and kind of economies of scale to get things moving, there's one thing that I've been battling to grapple with for some years, is that constitution speaks of a unity state, but then through negotiation we come to a state that has federal or quasi-federal elements to it. Okay. Now, 44% of the national budget gets transferred to provinces in equitable share or through conditional grants, which is a monstrous amount of money. But Chapter 3 of the Constitution says that government departments, vertically and horizontally, through the spheres and through themselves, have to, or they must cooperate with each other. Now, how, when you're trying to, for example, when you speak about you must go and you must plead with people to cooperate with you. You must assume that the various legislatures that are going to be appropriating money in a manner that is consistent with national policy, that's going to give that boost to the program. But there's nothing to enforce that. Only cooperation. Now, I would be interested to find out if you would consider looking at doing a research project on the governance system that is in the Constitution and the impact that it may have on service delivery. Because you see, we negotiated a settlement that we should never have negotiated. I mean, the information that we have now, we never had that information in 94 either. So the manner in which that is slowing down delivery to people, I think, is significant. And we need some institution that's credible like yourself to be able to put some research on the table so that we can start to persuade the powers that be that the structure that in the Constitution that determines how the country is governed is incorrect, in my opinion, or just hinders delivery. Yeah, thanks.
I'm still recovering from that input. No, I need that for another day. Chair, no, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity and the presentation. May I suggest that maybe in the environment that is not pressurized by material conditions that we find ourselves now that we need to rush and get the report done, that we really find some time to have some conversation with the institute, because I think there are a number of issues that we may not have sufficient canvassing on. because of the time pressure that we have right now. So I just want to throw that into the basket of things we've done for consideration. I'm sure they will be willing to engage further on this, because I think unless we also understand from the research perspective, I know earlier on there was a statement that we now have the power that we can now amend the money bills, we can pressurize to have more money put into either health or so and so. But in order to do that, there are certain things that we have to be clear ourselves around, to be clear and to be very convinced that this is the way to go after having a conversation, a sufficient conversation with yourselves. Let me leave that that plea aside and just quickly run through a few questions I have. I do have questions. I've got six of them, and I'll try not to motivate along at all of them. The first one, I think, is a matter that it raised around youth and the challenges that we have, and and link that to the growth path in terms of the slowdown that's been spoken about. Really, and of course, all what we have as a program to address the plight of youth, as some philosophers characterize it as unfinished business, the issue of youth being unfinished business. It continuously become unfinished business. What is it? I know there is a slowdown, there is 5 million jobs, there is a youth program, there's one NYDA, there's a whole lot of other things. But in your view, research view, what is it that needs to be done to give us a big leap forward in addressing that sea of a challenge? Given that we have all these others, but the dent, I would argue, is not noticeable. You also argue that it is not. So, in the kind of research, learning, understanding other countries in terms of the challenges, the similar challenges, what is it that can give us a really leap forward, given the challenges about a slow economic slowdowns and so on. But the problem staring us in the face, irrespective of all the global challenges. So that's really the first question I was wanting to. And I know that it may well be a question that requires a lot of conversation, but I want to put it in the things to be done. The second one, Chair, is the issue about education. I'm following on my other colleagues that have already ably dealt with the details. I just want to raise probably three things on education. The others we can come back to. The first one is this issue about the priority and directives given by the president. The president gives a direction in terms of what must be done, and that becomes a government program, and that becomes government priority, and the money and get allocated to it. So why is it that there is ongoing, not going to be completed, shifting of goalposts when it comes to what could be characterized as what is informs the direction, the norms and standards? Who must decide this? I hear about the council, I hear about all this, but the directions and the SONA has given a particular direction. Surely, some of those become a policy statement that finds themselves into what must be done by a functioning department. So, now I'm asking you what the hell is not necessarily a portfolio question. In your view, what's the fear here? Is a fear of quantifications and creating standard implications of budget that may well be happening, Andaman already the concern around the issue about 20% of the budget is already in education, and therefore, if you were to decide upfront of what the norms are, it would then basically nullify a lot of what we have as already infrastructure, and therefore has a particular implication. It never comes out here. Why these questions is never, it's a moving target, never going to be determined. Now you're speaking about guidelines, meaning that there's going to be standards can be determined depending on the people who issue in that particular, because this is really a guideline not to be followed. I mean, we look at the school in Eastern Cape, and I don't want to waste time. There's a mass school and all that. Now, is the issue of fear to decide not an escape clause to continue with the status quo where you have the non-habitable environment for as an infrastructure for education? Now, I just want to ask you if you could help us to understand this. So the second one is the issue about the projections of census that comes into it. The third issue is the simple SE analysis of projection of movement that has implications of infrastructure. I have asked this question to the education that they could not, and I ask, in terms of current patterns of society and the movement pattern that is suggested by the census, and the patterns of people moving, what does it tell us in terms of, you can even link it to 20 or 30 years planning commission's issue, but what does it say in terms of us looking futuristically, in terms of movement of infrastructure? Because we may also talk about it now, but only to see about the closure of 37 schools in the Western Cape, and then another so many schools is closing in another province. So we say, Western Cape closure of 37 schools, and another province says, but there's another close, then Western Cape says, it's a balance. We're closing here, and that's why we're also closing. So there is, we are reaching this equilibrium, so don't talk about it. So, okay, now you hear my point. You hear my frustrated point. I'm asking that question, so you may be able to help me that. The first question is really another issue about agriculture farming, the rest of it, that the doctor has ever spoken about. And I do think that is an area that we need to also sometimes find time to have some conversation. I don't know what should constitute a big turnaround strategy on this. I hear you talking about 15 billion that is being put into it, but does it make that impact that you need? If you're talking about people not being able to afford basic food, and your program and your budget choices that you're making, because already it's a priority, rural development is already a program, understanding the challenges. But therefore, what then constitutes the turnaround? Is a capacity issue, and that links to the resource question. Now, and of course, including the job issues, what are the options around public sector driven big cooperative, food cooperatives, put it different, put it simple as the way people will call it. I mean, China had their own, if you learn from basic food program from China, they had their own thing about basic food being a rice issue for everybody that day. So I'm asking in a context, if we are facing this, I don't know what is that degree. No. I'm speaking to the Let me leave the public sector driven, because I know that the fourth one was really around the best practice or what we can learn from other countries in terms of whether is what Judy spoke about the deeply in terms of the infrastructure council issues. Now, what is kind of best practice that we can learn, what we can learn from in terms of, so that it empower us when we speak about it, we also have the backing of information. Number five, I already touched this, the National Commission, the National Planning Commission issues and the lack of integration that informs the budget in terms of the what must be done. You probably have to, when you have time today, we will not have time. We speak a lot about the question that there is misalignment. You also talk about the misalignment in terms of the programs and the budget and the priorities. What must be done there? The last one, I left the important for last. You would have been surprised, Dr., if I don't speak about health. I have a few questions on that, perhaps, that we may just have to think about it, think through about it. And I think it must not, it is not be construed as the non-supportive issue around health and what objective around basic health for everybody is. But the funding model that you say the decline in terms of the budget is declining, this is a priority for government. Why is it declining? Now, I want to know, I just wanted to ask you the question, in terms of calculation of declining or maybe increasing, I don't know whether in terms of priorities and in terms of government budgeting, two-tier budgeting system in relation to health, whether the quantification of it takes into account the provincial following the line of March. Because I know, I also know that some provinces don't necessarily accept that national will give the lining march to say this is how we're going to march forward around health. They say, no, we are the government, we can also determine our own issues when we put budget. If you can explain that in terms of that budgeting in terms. Then the second one, these are the two similar questions. I'm a bit concerned, Doctor, about the two-tier regime. Because I'm hearing, and I may well be wrong because I'm less educated on this issue, more able about it. But I'm more hearing the national health, their unit, the normal process of primary health care that is proceeding. This one is the almost like the reinforced one that goes in. I don't know what those two units will do at the end of the process, at the end of the marriage, if you like. I don't know whether the implication, and I want to hear more and more about it, in terms of functionalities of suggested almost another regime that comes and this other will continue, but we're going to do this one, and later we're going to marry the two. Now, I thought, we're speaking about imposing of a system on top of a system that's not quite well functioning, which means that your budget that you have, you'll have to be determined in terms of who should do what, and you reinvent that to say in order to be able to do the work. Now, what I'm hearing, I'm simply hearing about almost like there's another regime that is being put in place, which is a separate regime that will run this one, and then later they will have to meet somewhere. Now the problem with something like that, it will end up with almost like a reorganization that happens at the end of the tunnel where comfort zone has been created on both sides. And you're going to have the whole challenges that you probably have in any department where you do the whole thing about reorganization and restructuring that comes with it. I'll leave my few questions, those six questions there, and we may have to have another conversation. I think it's the health one particular, I think it's for me is very important because I think it needs to roll out, but I know the other question has been asked about the funding model. I'm waiting eagerly for Treasury to come up with the models as well in terms of what this model is going to be. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. Maybe just before you respond, people. Maybe I shouldn't do like another Mastagan and say how many do I want to add, just to raise the questions I want to raise without giving the number of another one.
In her document refers to the unemployment for the youth, or putting the unemployment for the youth at about 42%. Now, I'm just asking myself, that exactly, if someone else comes after you to address us, I'm sure that person will give another number, percentage of the unemployed. Exactly, what is the correct number? Do we have the correct figure for the unemployed youth in South Africa? Do we know? I'm not sure, as I said, that I don't know exactly where you base your numbers, different institutions. The other question, maybe again to yourself, is the relationship between the one, is the relationship between the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission? Yes. I mean, now before we come to the relationship, I think that it has been there for a very short space of time. I don't know if the rest you have been able to assess its successfulness in terms of the job that it is doing. But clearly, I think that there might be gaps there, especially in terms of what it wants to achieve, especially around issues of accountability, corruption, and what. Now, the MPPBF seeks to establish a national procurement, what you call it, office. What do you think about this national procurement office? That's one. Now, coming to education, a lot of questions have been asked about education. I see that a lot of people come from that background. But what has not been mentioned in the document today, which in the previous presentations we have done, is the actual training of the teachers themselves. Do you think that we are making the government make sufficient progress in the actual training? Someone says this big, beautiful schools and what President will be launching one, by the way, honorable members. I've not been informed, I heard from the radio this morning in the Eastern Cape. So you have worked so hard that the schools are there, but when they are being opened, we're not invited. I hope they will still invite us. But now the issue of training, and perhaps, I mean, the training that is there seems to be a normal training that you find every day. And clearly, everyone says, in order for us to make progress, to break this unemployment and what, we need to have science and math, what you call a key subject. Does training really help? This focus, does it look at that focus as far as you are aware? Coming to health, well, the, I don't know,
Someone talked about the fear
in education for nonsense that
I'm not sure because I don't know if you, I think you spoke about the norms and standards office in when I say that they need to be established not just for in health, but I thought that the department was saying they are establishing this office. Has it been established now? Is it up and running? And the other question is related to NHI. There are 10 or 12 districts that have been identified. You know, to us, we thought that these districts, I mean, for me, I thought that they are district hospitals. But when we had a visit, we wanted to understand ourselves, and we found that a district means district in terms of a municipality. Is that what it is in the stage? Or does it, is there a relationship between a health district and a district for a single municipality or is there a relationship between that? The other question is just for Dr. Jacob. Around the job creation. This facilitation. Now, it's 5 billion. Minister, the other day, when presenting the MPBS, indicated that of that amount, only 1.8 has been spent. But it did indicate that the expenditure is very, very slow. Now, is there something that you think that can be done to at least assist the accelerate the process there? Then we're taking into account why the minister was subsequently to his presentation to parliament, we had a meeting with him, tried to explain why the process was low. But one colleague was saying, DBSA seems to be, everyone thinks that the panacea can deliver to everything in South Africa. Is it what we think it is, actually, and is there a way perhaps that we can be able to support? The last one, Dr. Jacobs, is around this rural cooperative bank. Has it been established? Is it possible to establish this rural cooperative particular bank? Yeah. So now on page 27. Okay, you want to make a follow-up?
Yeah, that's a very important one. That's a very important one. That's actually the one on cost. That construction one. Yeah, I think that is, because what is the budget for us? What is the positive implications for us in South Africa? How can we address the weaknesses of our projects? Because that is, with all the projects, we see there's problems, there's construction, but with funds and with tender fraud and with corrupt motives. Does it will that assist us? I know that it is funded by the United Kingdom, but the question is, I think we have something here. I'm very interested in that. We can get to have some background on it for that process.
Well, let me do what you did as well. The relationship between NYTA and what is NASIPO or what is National Youth beg you to come in.
Okay, so. Thanks, Chairperson. I'm going to divide up the questions according to the areas and based on the presentation. Let me start just by answering very briefly the question of the NHI funding, as to whether is there any funding, is there any plans in terms of calculation of how much money will be required. The green paper spells it out very clearly in greater detail. It spells out the fact that resources will be required for HIV and non-HIV services as well as administrative infrastructure. And based on the assumptions and the data that was available at the time, it was the 125 billion rand in 2012. And by 2015, it will be 156 billion. And the amount of money that is required is not all new money. The overwhelming majority of that money is already in the budget. There was a budget gap of around 5 billion as opposed to, you know, 20 billion or something like that. So it's not that the Department of Health did not, it's not that they did not actually plan. They have, but they have to refine it on the basis of evidence and new information coming in. For example, with the census data that has come in to show the population to be different, it's obvious that they have to go back and relook, you know, at it. Secondly, with the reduction in HIV mortality and the reduction in HIV incidence, it means that there has to be adjustments. So costing of NHI is always a concept in any country. South Africa is no exception to that. And then the next question that was asked of overall about this issue of the constitution saying we're a unitary state but heading for fiscal federalism in terms of finances and also in terms of planning, that, you know, everything seems to be done, you know, at the provincial level. It is a challenge. Canada is also experiencing the same thing, by the way. Yeah, I had the question was being asked about, you know, Canada in terms of, for example, national health insurance. They are able to say this is what can be done, but at the end of the day, there are provinces that are actually implementing that, and it is a problem. What we think we can recommend is, first of all, to accept the fact that it has to be a detailed study done, you know, there's no question about it. I think a study needs to be done. But also to look at the question of implementation of, on a pilot basis, of our Schedule 7. I'm aware of the fact that the Treasury has tried to do, not Treasury, but Department of Education with Treasury, have tried to do that, and they had some little bit of challenges. But I think we need more and more of those experiments that begin to show that you can implement the concurrent power issue, you know, between the national and the provinces in the areas of service delivery, education and health, you know, and so forth. So there is a need to really do a study on Schedule 7 itself to say if Schedule 7 were to be implemented to be the one that would really bring together the province and the national around the same agenda and around the same norms and standards, will it work or will not work within the same constitution, perhaps without even amending the constitution? I don't know, but I think it's something that we should investigate. The next issue that was asked on health was on the funding model, on why it seems like a spending and budget seems to differ, that you can allocate money to the provinces, and the provinces can buy that money and do something different because of the needs, you know, in that particular area. I do think, again, Schedule 7 would be the best way to go, because then you'll have to agree on what exactly should be implemented and you'll work on it together on the ground, as opposed to the conditional grant that you give in addition to the DORA, you know, I mean the amounts that are given directly to provinces where they can actually be able to change. That needs to be looked at very seriously, because it can threaten a very good national program. It can disintegrate in the province. Here the HSRC, I'm sure we should be looking at studies, trace of studies, that look at the money that was allocated nationally for specific activities in the provinces, how much of that money actually addressed the very issue that it was supposed to. Was there a requirement of that money or not? I think it is a study that we ought to be carrying out. And then the next one for the two-tier public and private sector integration is, so why do you wait until the end to begin to integrate that? in my presentation I indicated that the next 10 pilot districts were aiming to begin to do that, to begin to work out the contract between the public providers and the public service, and see if at all it could have a public funded system. Remember, the NHI is not an NHI system for the public sector. It's an NHI system for a publicly funded system, which is provided by both public and private. So in other words, there has to be some ways of contracting that would allow for this integration of both public and private to actually work. And that is supposed to be tested on the second set of districts, according to the green paper. And we're urging that the Department of Health must go back to the green paper to look at bringing in another 10 districts. The Treasury is being asked to actually put more money into that so that this part of it can actually be tested. The other question that came in was on the health of the Office of Health Standards and Compliance. Chairperson, I would like to say that the Parliament looked at the legislation itself, and once the legislation is all completed and is approved and all that and signed by the President, at that particular point in time, it can begin to be implemented. But in the meantime, the good thing is that they have already started appointing inspectors, so that as soon as the legislation and everything has been signed and it's all working, then the inspectors can be able to start doing their work on the ground. So that is a good development. In terms of the district municipality, district, 10 districts, are they different?
Can I just make a follow-up? But in terms of the whole NHI of the current concept, isn't a requirement the Office of the Norms and Standards?
It is a requirement. The NHI, the way it has been structured in terms of the plan, is supposed to have a number of units reporting to the minister. One is the Department of Health. Number two is the NHI fund. And number three is the Office of Standards and Compliance, even though it's a public entity separate, you know, in order to be able to monitor whether government is actually doing what it said it was going to do. It has been reporting, you know, to them. And of course, there are provinces that are actually linked up through the National Health Council. And then finally, in terms of the districts, whether are they health districts, are they different from municipalities? No, they're district municipalities. So there are 52 of them, so that there should also be governance issues that are actually linked together. So it's not like initially, I think around the 94, 95, 96, before they had this, merge of the district, the education district or health district or municipal district and all that. I think that has been sorted out pretty much in terms of the NHI, that they are actually integrated, you know, as one. Thank you. And we'll go to Judith.
Thanks very much. Just on the question around community projects and how one can link those better. I mean, obviously one part of this puzzle is the expanded public works programs, and so that is getting people onto these short-term contracts to do some of the work, building roads, etc. I think with the large-scale infrastructure may be a bit different, but certainly I think when I was talking about also the ways in which local communities benefit and are involved, and particularly through the economic linkages within those communities with regard to issues of housing and settlement, human settlement, spatial nodes, and also mobility. So are we giving thought to also the way in which people get from A to B to access economic opportunities? And these large-scale infrastructure projects is a way of dealing with that. But the question is, you're not going to be able to deal with it effectively unless people actually have a say about the development within their community. So that's a way of kind of participation. Obviously, there are ways in which one to break that down to kind of local economic development and job creation in those areas, and one needs to be creative about that, whether it's through partnerships between big companies and smaller ones, sort of different version, I would argue, of economic empowerment that we currently see, and hopefully that is exercising the minds of those who are providing those tenders. There was also, within the HSRC, we've done some work on state-owned enterprises and the way in which that might feed into precisely what you're asking. And I can certainly provide you with a copy of that study as well. Just on the question of the structure of government and the provinces and the local government. I mean, I think we've seen and we all agree that particularly around local government issues where we really are lagging behind on skills, capacity and so on. But it's the old chestnut. I think it's like dealing with, politically almost like dealing with the electoral system. And so we have this perennial debate around whether we should scrap the provinces, should we change the electoral system. But I think it is something that, you know, if one had real research on the kind of some of the deleterious effects and impacts of what we've been seeing, that might be something which is really useful. So I think, and certainly for my unit, and that's something that we will take up, and perhaps next year I can come back with something more concrete on that. On the best practice with regard to presidential, this infrastructure commission and how we've been doing, you know, I think it's very difficult to tell because, you know, as ministers said in the NCBPS, the rollout has been in different phases. And it is something to watch because what we have seen is a proliferation of commissions. You know, when we don't know what to do, we appoint a commission. And so are we going to, you know, is that just a way of kind of dealing with thorny problem? And is this really going to work? And your question on cost, well, that's precisely what cost is supposed to do. On the question of funding, it is, you know, the World Bank funded also some of the initial program. It's not really, to excuse the pun, cost heavy, because actually what you have is, what it does is it seeks to complement the country's existing mechanisms that it has for reporting. So whether it's the Auditor General's Office, whether it's whatever investigation, access to information, laws and so on. But it is about getting the information out there. And so the real nub of it is this multi-stakeholder consensus. We have people in the room to say we agree that we're going to do this in a way which is transparent. And that's really what you need. And that's not costly. So we have the Minister of Public Works has endorsed this at this meeting last week in Karteng. So hopefully that's something one can build on and say, well, if the Minister of Public Works has endorsed this, then, you know, one can move on to get other political and buy-in from different sectors. So I don't really see it as something which is costly and also getting business involved, which would be really good. On the question of the procurement office, I think it would be an excellent idea if it's supposed to be driven by the National Treasury, and we know the Treasury is effective in doing that. But it will be effective if we don't make another bureaucracy, and so therefore another layer of red tape for people to get through, to deal with, to get projects moving. And often what we see is that those are the kinds of blockages in the system. So it's fine for us to set it up, but let's not let stymie the issues. But I think it's a recurrent theme by Minister around the tender process, around the tendering database, which is basically non-existent. And so it's important, I think, but, you know, let's hope the office has been staffed well and that it's not a bureaucracy. There's, on the unemployment rate, different ways of measuring it in terms of the International Labour Organization's definition of unemployment. And those figures were actually figures from Statista, but the older ones, because obviously when I drafted the document, the census hasn't come out yet. So, thank you.
Thank you. I think there were lots of questions about education. But before I comment, just to say thank you very much for the engagement and about the education issues. And in a response, I'm going to try to, the point I want to make, thank you very much for engagement with research and science, and that is well appreciated, that in us presenting some of the scientific, the findings from our research and how that can inform the discussion and the debate. And in my responses, I'm going to try to use a hat as a researcher again, and I might not give the answers to it, but suggest more research, but certainly within that framework. I think the number of questions about education has just been indicative of the fact that education has been in the news from about July in not very positive terms, and so we have the strong concerns about education. And one is, the ASRC conducts the SAFER survey in June to February's department. And interestingly, last year, the public attitudes to education was fairly positive. they will be going to fields now, I think, or they're going to fields right now, and it'll be very interesting to see what are the general public attitudes about education this year from last year. Because, and public attitudes, perceptions, etc. are very important. Let me try to answer some of the questions. The question about whether kids today are smarter with their 7As rather than us with our season Ds that came out from the chicken, you get challenged by children about that. I think this question about whether kids 20 years ago were smarter and more prepared for university, you know, you read the literature and sometimes I read something written in 1990 and the introduction is exactly the same of we're concerned about the output from the schooling system and they're not prepared for university. So that's one thing that's there. And so it is a constant tension between the two groups. To ask the questions about the curriculum, and it's not that I'll answer anecdotally, that I do think, and I know maths and science best because that's my area, and I also work with my nieces and nephew in going through their preparing the exams or working through the homework. I do think that it's a very good curriculum. In certainly stated curriculum is very good. How it gets implemented is another question. It's a very challenging curriculum, and sometimes one looks at, I know it's been benchmarked against various other curricula and stands very well. Sometimes my own feelings is that I think it's too demanding on the students. And there's unrealistic expectations with regard to the mathematics. And so that's the anecdotal part of it. The science part of it is that to the very question that you asked about, you know, with the new curriculum, is there any equivalence with the older and how are the kids doing better at university? There was a piece of research at Fitz University by AMERO, the African Microeconomic Research Unit. And they did a very good piece of work and recently presented at looking at matric. And perhaps I could ask them to send that to the committee where this, I mean, every university asks the same questions and, you know, change the curriculum, therefore standards have dropped, etc. And they found that it hadn't dropped, but I think that's what the science is saying, but it's amazing how perceptions also strong kind of aspects of in the debate, and again to use this as a commercial break of on the 11th of December the HSRC will be releasing the International Maths and Science Study. Watch the space. And again, you know, we are benchmarking, benchmarking ourselves internationally and seeing how we're progressing, and so let's see on that there. To the question about the implementing agencies. I think, you know, the CEO mentioned that in terms of different programs, one should look at if we have a certain budget allocated, exactly how much goes to the program. If there's this budget for infrastructure, what exactly, if we do the analysis of the budget, is the amount spent on school buildings or school infrastructure? And what roles do the various implementing agencies play? I know that, for example, one of the questions that used to be asked of donor agencies, that given if a donor funding is this, how many cents of a rand is actually goes to who should be the recipients? And it gives you a clear understanding of what is the kind of cost all along the lines. And like you said, Dr. Sanan, we should ask those questions. And it's the kind of questions we ask about program, which is also not only in education but throughout. And as I said, I'm not totally immersed about infrastructure, but I was surprised that DBE was responsible for infrastructure, and we have a public works department, and it would seem to me, you know, people in public works would be far more familiar with what does it take to have building constructed, and Department of Basic Education understood was more curriculum and teaching and learning, but it is, and I think that those are questions that really need some sort of analysis of what is the best agency. And I understand that in the subsequent round in the Eastern Cape, Public Works will be involved, but in the previous ones, It was the DBSA.
But in this
Okay. In this Imvula Trust and others are being involved. So the DBSA, and there has been that delivery there. So it's more, I'm looking in terms of indicators of with as many implementing agencies and all the kind of operating management costs just along the line, what eventually becomes the proportion that's spent in schools should become an indicator we should use. The question about the looking at different schools and how do we plan, and I think that if you look at the CD program, it has been largely the response to the various outcries about the state of schools in the Eastern Cape, etc. And the question in the long term is, how do we set up a system and an information management system which keeps up-to-date information about the state or schools, whether it is about the land and the state itself, the number of classrooms, the state of desks, or what have you. And I think it's that we need to look for. And we need to also look in the long term that this national education, the infrastructure management system, is something that's up and live, so that at any one point one gets a sense of the state of schools and the kinds of, you know, it's got to be a very live system that gives one information. And it's that one that would lead to the long-term planning. And it's in terms of looking at systemically rather than the individual cases that I think would be important. Because we know right now also that 40% of all the schools at the moment still have a pupil-class teacher ratio of more than 40 students. I think the norm is about 1 to 35, but 40%, so 60% of the schools are low, but 40% is still a big number in what will be classified as overcrowded classrooms. I think the barriers to implementation is something that we've all discussed, and I think it's a very good, you know, I mean, it's certainly a challenge about that. The norms and standards question, why not norms and standards and why guidelines? I thought you would be able to tell us this forward. Again, in terms of just discussions around, I understand and that would, if there are sets of norms and standards, it means that there can be more legal challenges, because then there is this is what the norm and standard is, that therefore it should be delivered, and the guidelines doesn't allow for the same kind of, the legal framework around it is not the same. But it might not, I mean, as to that, my sort of layperson's understanding of that. I think also if we look at the education and education as a right, actually if you want to have a challenge, it's through the Constitution. There isn't a kind of, there isn't a legal framework that says that there will be a provision of education. So it's interesting when one looks at what can be legally challenged. I think the question about infrastructure and migration is something that perhaps rather than, if again looking at the census data, and I looked at KZN, and there's been a drop in the population in KZN to Gauteng and Western Cape. And anecdotally, I know it is young graduates, 10-year-olds that are leaving the province. So I can imagine a couple of years' time, the average age of the province is going to go up, and the young, bright mind and skills are going to move out of the province. So I think the CEO, I think it is a challenge for us to, in terms of looking in the sort of 20 years projection of what are the patterns, which is not only about the number of schools that one has to close down because you're going to have very few younger people in there, but just the skills base, et cetera. And I suppose that's part of what we have to challenge ourselves about the longer term research. It's increasing. Sorry, I just looked at the same one. There's a proportion. It's also aging. Okay. 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 So you come to the, is this the retirement place? And in terms of the training of teachers, and make the last comment there, that the Funza Vishaka Berkeley has an increasing number of teachers there, but of course the whole challenge of teachers is still present. The challenge and the emphasis now is we have math and science teachers, but the emphasis is on, we understand that it's the early years of learning that that will kind of prescribe what are going to be the outcomes later. And so the challenge that even in the minister's speech is the investment in grade R's. And while we've improved access tremendously, we still don't have enough trained grade R teachers, and the conditions of service for grade R teachers is different from the others. So that is the big challenge, and that is where the emphasis in terms of teaching is. I'm going to have to stop there. Maybe like the Honourable Minister said, but then we have to be other questions.
Yeah, I have to respond to two papers, and I've had quite a lot of questions on both papers. So I will have to try. I'll try and be very, very brief and to the point, because we are really out of time. But that's not going to make the chairperson very, very happy. Yeah. So on the first paper, I had I think two and a half questions. So the one question was about the, well, take them the easier of the two first. The one was on the jobs fund and the fact that the spending has slowed down and why the spending is so slow. My quick response to that is that the money that is sitting with the DBSA is certainly viewed as this kind of so-called cash cow, you know, that it will be a quick fix and everybody can just go there. I'm not so sure whether we want to improve the systems of getting access to that money, I'm talking about the job fund money now, or whether we should implement a different range of programs that could be supported through it. Because at the moment, I think there is a very heavy, probably an overemphasis on industrial-oriented types of projects, as against other types of projects, for example, more in my area where you want to support smallholder agriculture. Okay. And then, of course, issues around logistics and so forth. So there are two elements, but one of the elements which is fairly difficult to assess, which is, do we have the right mechanism to transfer the money? I think that requires a little bit more work at this stage. Then there were one or two questions about the issues on the reliability of existing statistics. Now, what we do know is that the census that came out yesterday peg the current jobless figure overall at 30%, its youth figure will be slightly higher because the overall figure for unemployment is 24.5% based on the quarterly the third quarter results that we analyzed. Now the youth figure depends on the cohort whether you want to use 15 to 25 or 15 to 35. Now if you look at the wage subsidy document, they use the 15 to 25, and so there is this, 70% of the people in the 15 to 25 cohort, they without work. And so if you expand it, then you have a completely different situation. In other words, you expect a cohort from 15 to 35. Okay, it's bound to come down because in the upper edges of your young population, you have more people in work.
The check of transfer interest, like, why do we start from 15? We have laws that say certain children of certain ages may not be employed and right.
As an economist, that's an international norm imposed by the International Labour Organization that the economically active population is between the ages of 16 and 65 all over the world, and that's the standard. Oh, 15 and 65. Now, of course, in various countries, they've got a variety of different ways of how they utilize whether you play female and male, and so your retirement age is 60 versus 65 and so forth. But that is a very technical thing that we cannot get around unless we change the International Labour Organization. Now, there was a question on how can we take a big leap forward on creating more jobs for young people? Now this sounds like a slogan from China, the big leap forward. And we've been buying a variety of interventions.
And there is, as I said, there is no quick fix. And at this stage, what I think we should be doing is we should be trying to learn from a variety of different experiences. And, for example, in the area of agriculture, we now all focus on the Brazilian case, Brazilian examples. Brazil is a very interesting case study, and the reason why it's an interesting case study is that they increased the minimum wage, right? But they created more jobs. Now, that goes against even how economics, the basic textbooks of what you guys have to read, eh? And so we all puzzled. Why? Yeah? And so we don't understand that yet. And so we have to try and do a little bit more work to understand those kind of dynamics, of the Brazilian case. So you've got a variety of different examples, and I think we've got to draw on a larger set of examples to understand what have we done to take a big leap forward in terms of job creation for young people. So let me come to the fascinating area where I'm really overwhelmed by all the questions, but also by all the wonderful contributions and wonderful insights, and I guess that in itself would be a research project just to bring together beautiful insights from Honorable Member Gelderbloem in terms of what can be done. Okay, so once again, I'm not going to spend too much time there. I think there are two things that we want to flag. Number one, please try and not only get more money for extension, but improve the quality of extension. That's what matters. That is what we now know from international experiences. The quality of extension. Now, what do we mean by the quality of extension? How extension officers are trained, how extension officers interact with smallholder farmers, the nature of advice being provided by extension officers to farmers, that's what we incorporate. So that's the first thing that we have to do. Now, I don't think I have to comment on the comment, earlier comment or claim that smallholder agriculture doesn't work. That goes against three of the leading reports that came out over the last 3 years. The World Development Report of 2008, 2011 International Food and Agricultural Development Report of 2011 on rural poverty, how to reduce rural poverty, smallholder agriculture. The latest report from the UNDP on human development, how to secure the future in terms of sustainable development, smallholder agriculture. Now, these are big institutions with a lot of reputation, and we got it recorded in the recent special issue of Development in Africa that I just entered, that just came out fresh off the press. There you'll find a lot of those insights and results carefully documented. We have copies, and we'll have an official launch in next year. Now let me jump to one or two of the other pressing issues. Quickly, the Rural Cooperative Bank is a new initiative from the Department of Rural Development. It has not yet been implemented, so there is no money flowing into its specific structure of how it's going to function. So we've got to wait and see. Wonderful idea. Have to wait and see whether it's going to work very well. And finally, I think I just need to make a quick comment on the wonderful idea. Two wonderful ideas. The first one is to streamline the variety of grants. Now, we wrote a very interesting study in 2009 for the DBSA of how you can, in a locality, optimize the benefits of multiple grants flowing into that locality. I'm not talking here about the best grant that sort of transfers you. I'm talking about MIGs and cultural development support grants and so forth. And that's a wonderful study of an experiment that we conducted of how these can be utilized to optimize rural development in an integrated way. And so that is a wonderful idea, I think, that we really consider to be a fascinating idea. Now, the big turnaround in agriculture, should we invest more in food cooperatives? Once again, lessons probably from China. Lessons from Brazil, they seem to be telling us something else, okay? Now, the Zero Hunger program that we're having at the moment is more based on the Brazilian Zero Hunger program, but only on one element of the Zero Hunger program in Brazil, which is on food production and not on the food distribution system. So we have to spend more time on the actual food distribution. In other words, how food actually flows into the basket of a specific household, how it gets prepared, and so forth. So those would be like my comments. But upfront, it's the quality of extension that's the key.
So you say we need to spend more time on food distribution rather than on food production. Did I hear you well?
If we compare the two departments, there are three departments concerned at the moment with food security issues. The Department of Agriculture, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, and Social Development. Right? Social Development, I think they have it right, because they emphasize this, that even increasing the solar grants by, you know, 6%, which is stand with inflation, is not going to help the Gogo to feed all the kids in the household. So they have to rely on, you know, the school feeding scheme and so forth. Right. So, but food distribution is vitally important, not only to enable people to afford more food, but the quality of food. So our colleagues in the public health division, they are real leaders at the moment investigating South Africa's food transition in terms of diet diversity. That's a very important issue. We can't just treat people like animals. They've got to just keep their tummies full. We've got to treat them as, you know, different kinds of animals. Thank you.
Chair, I did say that we don't have a lot of time, and I did plea that at some point we need to have this conversation at a little bit extended time. Now, Dr. Deko, you seems to be arguing slogans against the slogan of China. And I mean, and saying, well, but the question I'm asking that, are you saying that in terms of food production, that there is sufficient food production, and therefore the only problem that we are having currently is the issue about distribution thereof? But I think my argument is different. It's saying that if you're saying that people can't afford food, now I don't know whether that argument says that sufficient food, but is don't have sufficient money to afford food. But I seem to have heard you, that argument would be both. If you don't have food, there's more scarcity of food, it becomes more expensive, also it becomes in terms of demand, the whole thing about the demand and supply issues. I'm asking, are you saying therefore that the moment that the country, because I was asking the farms in terms of the turnaround, are we having shrinking farmers and therefore less production of food, or the both of the... So I think we need to have that conversation. I understand that at the moment, even the South African farming industry has shrunk from what it is to what it is today. And therefore the context of that is that it's going to be less of the production of food. So but I think that now, are you saying this is not production? The only problem is the issue of distribution. Because I'm almost hearing that.
Should I answer that, Chair?
Sure.
Because there's a wonderful
thing. In the response will also include the Chinese experience. Why?
I don't know, Chair. There is a seminar that I'm missing at the moment, which is about an intern, an alternative youth employment development model for South Africa. It's happening at the moment by those youngsters who sort of developed this model, and I'm really trying to get there. And I'm begging the committee that I will respond in great detail to this very complex question.
I agree.
Okay, are we covered or not, members of the question? Okay. You want your piping shot, I'm sure you
want.
Good night,
side, Chairperson, I would like to say we thank you sincerely for inviting us and having this exchange. I think it's a two-way exchange that we're getting. You're stimulating us in terms of our thinking and the kind of research that we're going to do. We do promise you that we'll continue coming to you on the basis of evidence that we generate. The questions that we ask, we'll try to do some research and then come back to you with some answers, you know, to some of the issues. If there's anything else that was not clear that you'd like us to be able to send to you, please let us know, and we'll send it to you, and hopefully you'll be better prepared when you're going to engage with the budget. Hopefully we'll have this.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our pleasure to listen from yourselves. I'm sure Honorable Ramaphosa is speaking on our behalf when he worried about the time that we're having. You know, we're under pressure. But I'm not sure if we'll ever get it right. Just to get one day, if we need to speak to Dr. Reddy about education, then we don't get another subject. Especially about rural development and and we focus on one issue. I'm not sure how we can get it right, all our members. But I think that is something that we would like to, it may not be one topic, maybe two, so that we can have a little bit of focus. But I can assure you that with the information that we've got today, I'm sure it will take us a long way. And also the correction about some perceptions, you know, you're thinking from scientific, what you call it, background rather than perceptions that may not be supported by any scientific research. We think that from our side, we really appreciate it. Dr. Jacobs, your talent is not going unnoticed. We'll come back to you. Thank you very much. If there's any need for a follow-up, we will do that. But I want to emphasize again that to us, it's more important that you come now, you know, rather than later. I think to us, that's more than the most important area. But not that if we need your assistance, we will not invite you at any other time. I'm sure we'll certainly do that. Thank you very much. And in fact, honored members, we're sitting this afternoon at 3. We're supposed to do the first quarter report today. But with your permission, I suggest that we do it on Friday because we need to adopt it. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.